How you doing?
Senate Judiciary, be in order. Secretary will take the roll, please.
Vice Chair McGilvery.
Here.
Vice Chair Sands.
Here.
Senator S.
Here.
Senator Heinbaugh.
Here.
Senator Bennett.
Here.
Senator Manzella.
Here.
Senator Weber.
Here.
Senator Brown.
Here.
Senator Friedel.
Here.
Senator Gross.
Here.
Chairman Regeer.
Here. Committee, we have four bills that we're going to hear today, and then if we have time, do some executive action. For those of you in Zoom land, executive action will be in this order: House Bill 382, 382, House Bill 439, 439, House Joint Resolution 4, House Bill 229. Those of you that are here to testify, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. There's a sign-up sheet at the entrance. And whether you're here physically or on Zoom, give us your name and spell your last name at the beginning of your testimony. And those of you that are on Zoom, do not raise your hand. We will call on you. With that, Senator S.
Members of the committee, we are going to open the hearing on Senate Resolution 47. Senator Regeer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I am Keith Regeer, that's R-E-G-I-E-R, Senator from Senate District 3. I bring to you Senate Joint Resolution 47. This is the appointment of Peter Oman to the 18th Judicial District, that's in Bozeman, and I will step aside and let him tell you about himself.
Thank you. Judge Oman, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Oman, O-H-M-A-N, and thank you for having this hearing today on my confirmation. I'm currently a district court judge in Gallatin County, and I'm a district court judge along with two other judges, Judge Rhea MacLea, who's here today, and Judge John Brown, who overslept a little bit, but he's speeding up here quickly to make it for the hearing. I'd like to thank, first of all, the many people that have come in to support me here today, both personally and also on Zoom. I'd also like to thank my wife and my two children who are up in the gallery, Francis, Audrey, and Gavin. And Gavin was supposed to wear his tie, but I think it fell down between the front seat and the console as we were driving up here this morning. So,
we'll
try to make him a little more presentable next time. I was thinking, I've been thinking about what I was going to say to this committee for the last 3, 4, 5, 6 months since I got appointed. I got appointed in late September, and I was, as many of you know, I was working at the Public Defender's Office then, and I quickly transitioned. As soon as I found out about the appointment, I started taking vacation from my job, and I went over and I shadowed Judge Holly Brown, who was my predecessor, for 2 weeks. And then I got on the bench on October 9th, or I got sworn in on October 9th, and then I started on October 13th, I think it was. And so I've been basically doing this job probably for about 6 months or so, and it's been a whirlwind. It's been a great experience, and I've been learning every day. I thought what might be good for all of you is to find out a little bit more about me and what my background is and what I've done over the last 25 years that I've been practicing law. And so I'm going to run through that, and hopefully that'll give you a good indication of why I at least think that I'm qualified to do this position. I graduated from law school in 1995, and early in my career, I initially came back here to Montana. I went to law school in Portland, but early in my career, I went down and I worked in southeastern Kentucky, in Appalachia. I worked in Hazard, Kentucky, and I worked for legal services down there. I did a lot of domestic law, a lot of family law. I did some consumer law. I did some property law. And then I also did some administrative law with respect to public benefits. And then I also did bankruptcy law when I was down there. I worked there for a couple of years, and then I came back up to Montana in 1998, and I came here to Helena, and I got a job with the Department of Commerce. And when I was initially at Commerce, I worked in the Occupational Licensing Division, which is now in labor. Back then, it was over in Commerce. And so what I did in that job is I represented boards in as counsel for boards. So I represented the accountants. I represented the real estate appraisers. I represented private investigators, cosmetology, nurses, and many other boards. And then I also prosecuted, for lack of a better term, licensees who had violated the rules and regulations that applied to their board, applied to their professions. So, for example, I know we had a case with respect to an appraiser once where there was a dispute as to whether or not the appraisal was done properly. I did a 3 or 4 day contested hearing on a nurse anesthetist who had been illegally taking fentanyl from one of the cabinets and using it prior to him engaging in his practice, and we were successful in that case. And so those were the kind of things I initially did at Commerce. About halfway through my term there, I ended up moving over to Maine Commerce, and I acted more as a general counsel for the agency, advising them on HR issues, on contract issues, on issues with respect to compliance, obviously, with legislation that comes out of this body, and then also administrative rules. Then I also, when I was there, I ended up working in the Consumer Protection Division, which at that time was at Commerce. It's since been moved to the Attorney General's office, but at the time it was at Commerce. And so I did a lot of work under the Montana Consumer Protection Act. I did some Unfair Trade Practices Act work, which also bled into some antitrust work. And I did that until I left Commerce and left working for the state of Montana in 2001. In 2001, I moved back down to Bozeman, and I opened up a private practice. And when I did that, I did some landlord-tenant work, representing landlords and tenants. And I also I did some more consumer protection work. I did a little probate work. And then that's when I started getting into criminal defense. I had never touched a criminal case in my first probably 6 to 7 years of practice. But I got a contract with the Bozeman Municipal Court to do public defense. And I found that I really enjoyed the work. I enjoyed it because it got me into court. I like being in court. I like making arguments. I like advocating for clients in court. I really enjoyed the constitutional element of it, trying to protect people's constitutional rights. And then I also just enjoyed working in the community as well. During that time, I also taught business law at Montana State University. I did that for 2 semesters. And then I was also, I had a contract with the Better Business Bureau, so I was kind of their Montana contact to do mediation with businesses and consumers who had had issues throughout whatever transactions they might have had here in the state. In 2003, County of Gallatin, Gallatin County, decided that they were going to take over the public defender system. And so I was really enjoying working in private practice, but I thought that that was a good career move to move to the public defender's office. So I took a job there at the end of 2003, and I was soon promoted to chief deputy counsel for that office. And things really took off. We were extremely busy. I started doing felony cases. I'd previously been doing misdemeanor cases. And then I was also quickly involved in child welfare cases, the abuse and neglect cases that I know there's been some legislation here pending in front of this committee and I think in the House this session on child welfare issues. So I quickly got involved and up to speed on those. And then in 2006, the state took over the public defender system, statewide system. And I was hired as the regional deputy public defender. And so what that was is that I managed the office that covered Gallatin County, Park County, and Sweetgrass County. And so we provided, obviously, services with respect to criminal matters, also the child welfare matters. But we also expanded a little bit in that we end up doing guardianship and conservatorship cases, too, as well, when there is a protected person that is entitled to counsel. I also, while I was working in the public defender's office, did a lot of civil commitment proceedings. And then also one of my specialties, as I just kind of developed it, was working in juvenile matters. And so I did that until the end of 2013 or 2014. And then I was appointed to become the statewide training coordinator for the Public Defender's Office. And so I did all the training for all the attorneys, our 150 attorneys and 200 contract attorneys, our investigators, our social workers, and then our support staff. And I did that for about 3 years. And so then what happened is in late 2016, 2017, we were advised, the Public Defender's Office was advised that our need for a supplemental was not going to be supported by the executive. I think most of you know OPD has come in and asked for a lot of supplementals over the years. And so coming up to the 17th session, basically it was like, you're on your own. You need to figure this out. And so we had hired right around that time a new position for OPD, which was more of an administrator, a chief administrator for the office, because there was a concern that the office was being run by a bunch of attorneys who weren't really that maybe well-trained to deal with administrative budget matters and things like that. So we hired a chief administrator who was going to try and kind of run that part of the agency and let the attorneys worry about the legal work, but have an administrator that could look at HR issues, budget issues, things like that I mentioned. The pressure was building. Right around December, just before the session started, our chairman of our commission, we had a commission at that time, resigned. The individual who we had hired to be this new administrator position resigned. And there was definitely a fair amount of angst, I guess I could put it, at OPD, and I was in the mix there. So I volunteered to move into that administrator position to try to help as best I could with the agency making it through the 17th session. And so during the 17th session, some of you might recall HB 77. I think that's what it was. I was Representative Brodel's bill to reorganize the Public Defender's Office. And so I came in and worked with him and Representative Patelis and a bunch of other people, and mostly coming out of Sub D, to try to work on that reorganization and then also work on our budget. And then also that was when justice reinvestment was going through the legislature. And so I was involved with a lot of those bills. In particular, HB 133 was something that I'd worked on a bit. And that was in front of House Judiciary, I'm sure. I think maybe Representative Brown and Representative Manziel might remember some of the... I think there was quite a bit of debate on that. I think it got tabled and then maybe it got brought back up. But right, it's so... So, yeah, it's a few years ago, but we all remember some of those days. So I worked on that through the 17th session. We got funded. We got our reorganization done. And then in 2017, in the summer of 2017, I was hired as the Public Defender Division Administrator. And the Public Defender Division Administrator managed, as I always put it, the trial division at OPD, which was about two-thirds of the agency. So I had about 225 employees working for me. And then I managed all the regions, such as the one that I used to work for down in Bozeman and Livingston and in Big Timber. And so in that capacity, I did obviously a lot of HR work with that many people there. But I also managed to remain involved with cases on a regular basis. People would call me up asking me for advice on how to deal with different situations because at the end of the day, I did have a lot of experience. And then also, I did have to do a couple of writs to the Montana Supreme Court on appointment of counsel issues. And one of them was with respect to a qualification, whether or not somebody qualified for counsel due to their income. And then another one was kind of an outgrowth of 133, whether or not counsel could be appointed for individuals who weren't facing jail time, which was one of the whole ideas behind 133 is if you're not facing jail time, then you don't automatically get a public defender. And so 133 removed jail time for a lot of low-level misdemeanors, and that, in result, reduced the caseload for OPD pretty substantially and resulted in some savings. And so that was one of the other writs that I brought up, and the Supreme Court agreed with us and said that we don't have to provide counsel in those kind of situations. So that, in a nutshell, is 25 years of practice. That brings us up to 2000. And just so you know... you know, I'd thought about being a judge. I was happy where I was. I know what a hard work it is to be a judge and what the caseloads are like and how much time you have to put in and emotionally what a commitment it is. And so so I thought about it, but then some people had reached out to me and said, are you going to apply for the vacancy that Judge Holly Brown's vacancy will create? And I thought about it, and I went back and forth a bunch of times. And then eventually I decided to give it a shot, and I did. And like I said, I got the appointment, and then I started, I think, on October 13th, full-time. The first day that I was in court, I had 26 hearings, and it just hasn't let up since. It's just constant. I've been, I work about 6 days a week. I think there's been 2 weekends since I started where I haven't worked on the weekends. But like I said, I knew that going in, and that's fine. It's an important job. You want to make sure that you're prepared when you come into court. You want to make sure the litigants understand that you're prepared, that you've read the briefs, that you're familiar with the file. And that means a lot to people, that they know that you care about their cases, and they know that when they're appearing in front of you. And also even, the reason that we needed to reschedule this was just due to my calendar, and thank you, Senator Regeer, for moving this to Friday. I appreciate it. So with that experience, I just felt like, I was qualified for the position. I've done family law, I've done criminal law, I've done probate law, I've done guardianships, conservatorships, civil practice, criminal practice, child welfare cases, civil commitment cases. I haven't done everything, but I've done quite a lot. And so I thought that I was qualified for this position, and I hope that you'll agree that I'm qualified for this position. Just a couple of other things that I'd like you to know. One of the actual real draws for me about this particular seat in Gallatin County in Department 1 is that I get to be, I'm not obviously the water court, I think you had Judge Brown up here earlier who was asking for your confirmation, but I work with the water users. And so my role as Department 1 is that I will appoint the water commissioners, and we have 3 water commissioners in Gallatin County, and the water commissioners are the ones that manage the ditches and manage the allocations when things get tight. And so that's one of my responsibilities. And I was fortunate enough to go out with George Alberta, who's been the longtime commissioner on the Gallatin this fall. And he took me out and showed me all the ditches around that are just for the Gallatin, not all the ditches in Gallatin County. Showed me all the ditches, showed me the canals, and which is really a cool thing to see because I've been driving around Gallatin County for the last 31 years. And I didn't know there was a ditch over there. I didn't know there was a canal over there. And there'd be a row of trees. And I was like, oh, that's actually a ditch. And I'm also not as much anymore, but I've done a lot of whitewater kayaking. And I probably paddled House Rock 250, 300 times. And every time I go by the West Fork Canal, and I didn't know what it was. I figured it was, something. But now I know what it does and where it goes, and I know where the other diversions are. So that's been really neat. And also, Gallatin County has 2 dike and drain districts, 3 forks in the Madison. And if this body is kind enough to confirm me, I'm really looking forward to getting out and meeting with the agricultural community, working with them to resolve disputes before they get to court. And then also just learning more about that history of Gallatin County, because I'll tell you, with what's going on down there, it's certainly something you can miss. When I started when I was doing my 2 weeks of shadowing Judge Brown, there's something that she said that really stuck with me about just generally being a judge. And she said, go to the code. Just go to the code. And so what that means is that, my desk is right here. And so pretty much the only exercise I get all day is I get up, and I walk over, and I pull out the code, and I walk back, and I open it up, and then I look at the code, and I try to apply it for whatever case there is at hand. So that's what I'm doing here today. I know there's some concerns that people are going out and trying to, legislate from the bench or whatever, but that's what I'm doing. I just go to the code. And then I try to apply that to the issue at hand. I know very well that the place for making policy is right here. It's in this room. It's in the rooms over there. It's in the rooms downstairs. It's back there. It's downstairs. I've been in all of them. I know that that's where policy is made. And I have absolutely no interest in legislating from the bench. If I wanted to continue to work on policy issues, I've been up here since 09. My first session, I think, was actually 1999 that I lobbied when I was working for Commerce. If I wanted to do policy, then I would be up here trying to work with all of you to develop policy. But right now, what I'm trying to do is take the law as you've written it, apply it to the case at hand, and decide the case fairly, and get decisions out the door quickly, and make sure people have their day in court, and we can move the docket along. Also, since I've been here, I've been working with child welfare cases. And those are cases that I worked on the court improvement project. Before, it was one of the committees that I worked on before I took this position. Incidentally, I think I've resigned from every committee and board that I've been on since I got on the bench, which is appropriate. But one of the things that's been good since I got there is that I'm just starting to get to know the families. Because when I was a public defender, I used to be able, you know, I'd sit down and meet with them in my office. We'd be able to visit for an hour. I would get to know who they are as people. And then we would move on to the hearings, and I'd make my arguments, and things would proceed. It's a little bit more difficult as a judge because you're sitting, there's some distance between you. It's a little artificial with respect to the exchange. But after having a few hearings, I'm getting to know these people, and hopefully they're getting to know me a little bit more and trust me that I actually have their interests in heart, and I'm just not some automated judge that's just kind of checking off the boxes. In particular, there's a young man that I've gotten to know over the last few months. He's a ward of the state, so he's been removed from his home. His parents' rights have been terminated. He's in a facility up in Idaho, and we've been able to visit a few times. We've talked about pump tracks, you know, for BMX riding and what he wants to do. He wants to go to Job Corps and work out in the woods. And whenever I ask him, you know, do you want to meet again in 6 months or do you want to meet again in 3 months? He says 3 months. And then he asked me the other day, he's like, well, what do you do? And so I got to tell him, like, I'm looking out for you. You know, I want to make sure that what's happening in your life, because you're a ward of the, I didn't say ward of the state, but because, you know, the state has custody over you, I want to make sure that you're safe in your placement and that they're treating you well and you're getting an education and things are going all right. And so I think we had that nice exchange, and I think that he trusts me now, and so I'm hoping that I can continue to have those kind of communications with him. So in closing, what I would like to guarantee to all of you is that if I was to be confirmed, there's three things that I will do. Is one, I will bring humility to the bench. Two, I will bring a hard work ethic with my experience. And number three, I will stay in my lane. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. We'll now take proponents for Senate Resolution 47. Any proponents in the room? And line up if you feel comfortable doing that so we can move along. Go ahead.
Good morning. Rien Maclier, R-I-E-N-N-E. Last name is M-C, capital E-L-Y-E-A. Chairman, members of the committee, I am a district court judge in Gallatin County. I am in charge of Department 2 for Gallatin County. So I'm along with Peter Ullman, one of the three. As I think this chamber knows, we are at a tipping point in Gallatin County. We have, at this time, we need 6.78 additional, or 6.78 judges. We have three. And what that translates to is in order for us to keep our head above water, we have an obligation constitutionally to make sure criminal cases and the rights of speedy trial are addressed, that for dependency and neglect action cases, that we take care of the statutory mandates and get those cases through. There are other cases, such as involuntary commitment, that require our immediate attention, as well as hearings for youth in need of care, or youth cases. So what happens as a practical matter is that civil cases end up getting to the bottom of the barrel. And how that translates on a just practical day-to-day basis is that if your daughter is suffering in a domestic abuse case and needs a divorce, it's going to take her 2 to 3 years to get through the court system in Gallatin County. If you're a business owner in Gallatin County and need immediate attention because you're having a business dispute, it's going to take you 2 or 3 years to get through the cases in Gallatin County. What we have today is a request of this body to confirm Judge Peter Oman. I was not very familiar with Judge Oman before he came on the bench, but what I've seen since he's been here is he is hardworking, dedicated, reasonable, and a really legal mind. I have quickly used him as a resource when I have a difficult question in mind, and he's been able to provide me with guidance. Gallatin County is really fortunate to have Peter Oman as its jurist, and I really urge this body to confirm him. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Krista Lee Evans. I'm here today on behalf of AGI, the Association of Gallatin Agricultural Irrigators. And as Judge Oman mentioned, the Gallatin County judgeship that he is filling in, we've always had a really good relationship with Judge Hawley and have had a good relationship with Judge Oman since he has come into the position. For those of you that aren't familiar with how water right enforcements work, the Gallatin is currently operating under a temporary preliminary decree from the water court. The water users petition the district court for enforcement. So that essentially means that a court-appointed commissioner delivers the water. And the commissioner usually doesn't go on or won't go on because we as water users pay the bill. We won't petition for a commissioner until or when water starts to become short. And so the Gallatin is an example of how the water rights administrative process is supposed to work as far as water distribution on the ground. We're excited to work with Judge Oman. He's reached out to us as the irrigators. He's spent time on the river. He's learning about our conveyance systems and where they are and how they work and the importance of them to the valley from a multiple different perspectives. So we do support Judge Oman. We look forward to working with him in the future and would appreciate your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. Further proponents?
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Brown. I'm the third district court judge in Gallatin County. I'm going to be brief today. I first met Peter when I became a judge on 14 years ago when I got on the bench. And at that time, he was working for the public defender's office. Later on, he ran the public defender's office. And then as he testified, he went on up the ladder. Judge Oman is a very good judge. He's been there now for about 6 months. From my observation is he runs a good courtroom. He follows the law. He's firm when he has to be firm, but he's also polite. He's polite to litigants. He's prepared when he goes to court. He does everything that you would want a good judge to do. He is neutral. He does not have an agenda when he goes to court. His job, like all of us, is to follow the law, try to do the right thing. He has earned the respect of the legal community in Bozeman. He's supported, I believe there's a letter that has been submitted on behalf of the Gallatin County Bar Association, so he's supported by the attorneys. He's also supported by law enforcement. He's supported by the Gallatin County Attorney's Office. I believe there are a couple members of the Gallatin County Attorney's Office here today that are going to testify to confirm that. As for just the district itself, as Judge McLeay testified, we're a very busy district. And I know hopefully the fourth judge will go through, but as it stands right now, we have enough work for almost 6.78 judges, and there's three of us. So we actually have literally twice as many cases as we should have. I have twice as many criminal cases because we have work for six, and there's three of us. It's very important that the judges get along. Peter's very agreeable. He works with us. We have no problem. We are a good group, and that's been the history of the district as long as I've been there. When I started, I was with Judge Salvani and Judge Holly Brown. We've always gotten along well, and that's really important because we have so many things we have to deal with. The judges have to be on the same page. So he's very cooperative. He's a really smart guy, and he's a really good judge, and that I hope that you confirm him. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Brown. Further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Brewer, members of the committee. I'm an attorney from Bozeman. I have practiced there for approximately 16 years. That's when I met Peter Oman. I've known him ever since. He was my boss at the Public Defender's Office for some years, and I have tried cases with Judge Oman. I find him to be an extraordinarily reasonable fellow. I have never seen him take an extreme position on anything, and I find that to be a very good quality in a judge. I have also never seen Judge Oman lose his temper, even in very stressful situations. And I tell you this because that tells me that Judge Oman has what we refer to as judicial temperament. When Judge Oman took the bench, I know that the Gallatin County Attorney's Office was a bit concerned that Judge Oman might lean toward sympathizing with the defense. I think that you see there are three members from the Gallatin County Attorney's Office here. They have not, from what I hear, they don't seem to think that he has done that. I also know that Marty Lambert, the county attorney from Gallatin County, wrote a letter in support of Peter, and Mr. Lambert is never one to remain quiet if he doesn't like something. So that really speaks quite a bit to me. I personally was concerned that because of Judge Oman's background as a criminal defense attorney, he might hold criminal defendants to a higher standard or hold criminal defense attorneys to a higher standard. That has not been true either. Judge Oman so far has been absolutely nothing but fair. And finally, because I don't want to take too much of your time, I do want to note that Judge Oman has some experience that a lot of individuals do not bring with them to the bench. With all due respect to Judge MacLeay and Judge John Brown, I don't, to the best of my knowledge, neither of them came to the bench having any direct experience with involuntary mental health commitment cases, with youth in need of care cases, or with representing juveniles in the youth court. Judge Oman has very personal and a lot of experience in all three areas of those areas of the law, and these are areas that affect people for a very, very, very long time that I don't think a lot of people understand that these areas are even potentially out there, and Judge Oman brings great experience with that. So with that said, I urge the confirmation of Judge Oman, and before I forget, one of my colleagues asked that I bring a letter that she was not able to send on time, and I was wondering if I might enter it into the record.
Yes, give it to the secretary, and sir, did you spell your last name?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the proponents.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bjorn Boyer. That's B-O-Y-E-R. I'm a prosecutor at the Gallatin County Attorney's Office. And Mr. Brewer is completely right that if you would have told me 6 months ago when Judge Oman took the bench that I would be here today testifying on his behalf, I would have been surprised to find myself here today. I think we are all very apprehensive about having a career defense attorney be the judge, that he might favor criminal defendants. And honestly, we have not found that to be the case. He's a judge that has shown that he cares deeply about community safety. Repeatedly when he's doing sentencing or bail hearings, he references that. He references that he's doing something in the interest of community safety. And as prosecutors, that's probably the thing that is most important to us. I also spoke with the detectives at the Gallatin County Sheriff's Office yesterday. They were going to submit letters on his behalf, but they didn't realize that there was a deadline to do so. And so when I spoke to them last night, that deadline had already passed, but they wanted me to pass along that as members of the Sheriff's Office, they've gone and gotten search warrants from Judge Oman, and that they honestly were very apprehensive initially about Judge Oman being on the bench as well, but they have also found him to be an incredibly fair judge. He's already handed down several sentences in serious sex crimes or sex abuse cases that I've prosecuted, and I can tell you again just from that experience that he is very concerned about public safety. I think the last thing that I'd like to mention is just kind of how rare a situation this might be. Mr. Brewer, who I have a lot of respect for, but you don't find us agreeing on something very often. You don't find members of the defense, members of the prosecution, even sometimes the judges all agreeing on one thing, and I think we're all very much in agreement that this committee should recommend Judge Ullman for confirmation, and I'd urge you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boyer. Further proponents?
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Erin Murphy.
Will you pull that mic just a little closer, please?
Sure. Sorry about that. I'm kind of short. Mr. Boyer's a little taller than I am. My name is Erin Murphy, M-U-R-P-H-Y. I am a deputy Gallatin County attorney. I first started working with Judge Ullman when I started at the county attorney's office just about 12 years ago. One thing that I found right off the bat with Judge Ullman was that even though he had a lot more experience than I did, I was a brand new attorney, he always treated me with respect. And I always appreciated how thorough he was with his cases. And when we met and when we had hearings, that he was always prepared, but it was never personal. We were always arguing an issue and could treat each other with respect. And I echo what Mr. Boyer said, and I think that Judge Ullman recognized that the prosecutors might be apprehensive about a career defense attorney being on the bench. But Judge Ullman, immediately upon his confirmation, came and he met with us at the county attorney's office. He discussed any issues that we thought we saw, and he also wanted input from us and our opinions on how to make the court more efficient, because we are, as you've heard, overwhelmingly busy. And he wanted to know how we could work together to get cases through the court system, to get cases resolved, and I think that he has done that. And I feel there was no blip in the calendar when he took the bench. He was appointed, and he took the bench, and as he said, that first day he had numerous hearings, and that's really his law in motion day for criminal calendars is Tuesday, and it's not out of the average to have between 20 and 30 hearings set on those days, and you have to get through them quickly. And Judge Ullman, because of his prior experience, has done those hearings and knows how to move through them efficiently, but also knows when he needs to take time and listen to arguments on bail, listen to witnesses who take the stand, and I've seen him do that. He listens to all of the sides, and then he makes a fair and well-thought-out decision. I've also seen that in his written decisions on substantive motions. While I may not agree with everything that he has done or all of the rulings that he's made, they're all very well thought out, supported by the law and the facts, and you can see all of his reasoning and how he got to his conclusion. I would also say that he treats everyone who comes into his courtroom with respect, from involuntary commitments who are in maybe their worst possible place, they're in a severe mental health crisis. He works through them and works with counsel and works to reach resolutions that get those people to a safe place. He also cares about all of the attorneys and the people that come before him, so those of us that he's known for a number of years and the newer attorneys. He checks in on people and asks each of us, you know, how was your weekend? How are you doing? And I think that shows his concern for the Bar Association. We are a small, close-knit Bar Association in Gallatin County. You can see how much support he has from the Bar Association. But we are very busy, and it's good to check in with people and make sure everybody's doing all right. And Judge Ullman does that, and I think it shows that he cares about all of those people that come in front of his court. I also did have the opportunity to speak with our detectives, as Mr. Boyer did. They are in support of Judge Ullman, and they were apprehensive at the beginning, but they very much appreciate how available he is when they call for search warrants and the time that he takes to review them and his thorough review of the search warrants that they bring in front of him. So I appreciate you listening to me here today, and I would ask that you confirm Judge Peter Ullman to the 18th Judicial District. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Further proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jordan Salo, last name S-A-L-O. I am a deputy county attorney in the 18th Judicial District. I've been a prosecutor for just under 6 years, grew up in Bozeman, was born and raised there. Currently, I have over 200 criminal cases, ranging from homicide, attempted homicide, to possession of dangerous drugs, and everything in between. And those cases are split between each of the district judges in our district. I will try to keep my testimony fairly straight to the point as to not waste your time. As everybody has touched on already, our dockets are extremely overcrowded. And as many of the senators in the other hearings brought up, the biggest issue that we have right now is speedy trial. We literally have cases right now being set in 2022. Many cases are already being set, stacked settings, in December and November of this year. So if we go down to two judges, there are going to be cases that get dismissed due to speedy trial issues. And I can't imagine having that conversation with a surviving victim that a case had to be dismissed because we just simply didn't have the manpower to get the cases tried. So I just ask that you remember that these are real people, these are real defendants, real victims, as we move forward. Besides just the need to have Judge Oman on the bench, I'll give you two examples from practicing in front of him. Instead of just giving you essentially the thumbs up, I'll give you two very specific examples from practicing in front of him, one of which was from a criminal felony assault with a weapon case that I had in front of him. I think it was actually the first criminal jury trial that he presided over because of COVID. And moving through that trial, trying to adhere to mask mandates and all of the other things to do with COVID was challenging, and having a judge who has that criminal law background was excellent, and I think it would have been a train wreck had it been an inexperienced judge. The main issue that came up during that trial actually involved the defense attorney trying to raise an affirmative defense in the middle of trial after I had rested my case. Against statute, I had not received proper notice pursuant to statute, and Judge Oman addressed it properly. He took brief oral argument and ruled that the evidence was not admissible. Obviously, I agreed with that. And I use that as a specific example because I have had other cases where defense attorneys have raised affirmative defenses after not giving us proper notice, and they were allowed to bring that affirmative defense in, which wrecks a prosecution when you don't have proper notice. So, again, I use this as an example because I actually lost that trial. And I lost that trial because of the evidence and the facts of the case. I couldn't walk away and say that the judge let in improper evidence, let the defense just do whatever they wanted. I lost because of the facts and the evidence, and that's the way that it should be. One other example that I will give is a sentencing hearing that actually Ms. Murphy had to cover for me because I had to be in another court. But it was my case. It was a strangulation case. And this defendant had a history of domestic violence, and he was actually on probation, felony probation, when he picked up the new strangulation case. And during that sentencing, Judge Oman pointed out a tattoo that that individual had on his arm. And I quote for the record that that tattoo read, "Bitches ain't shit." And in his reasons for sentence, Judge Oman noted that tattoo, and that tattoo told him exactly how the defendant felt about women and how he viewed women. And based on other factors, criminal history and whatnot, Judge Oman actually jumped the plea agreement and sent that individual to the Department of Corrections for a custodial sentence. Those are two examples of just how, as a prosecutor, I was extremely hesitant having a lifelong defense attorney coming onto the bench, but how I have been so pleasantly surprised. And my last topic is going to be based on that. He has criminal experience. Judge McAleer and Judge Brown come from civil backgrounds primarily. And having a judge with criminal experience in that mix is needed. The last criminal judge that we had, or background, I should say, was Judge Salvani, who actually retired like right as I came back. So I have never had a district court judge that has a criminal background on the bench, and it is desperately needed in our district courts. So my final representation to you all is that you all don't know me. These judges do. My other county attorney, deputy county attorneys, and Mr. Lambert, who I believe is on Zoom, will tell you that I am slightly opinionated and that I am not afraid to voice my opinions. And the reason that I bring that up to this committee is that if I did not think that Judge Oman should be on the bench, I would not be testifying as a proponent of this SR 47. And I ask that the committee confirm his appointment.
Thank you, Ms. Zalo. Further proponents, please. Welcome, Mr.
Vice
Murphy.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Murphy, and today I represent just myself. In listening to Judge Oman's recitation of his experience, I think I've known him the entire time that he's been practicing criminal law. I may have had the first case against him in Gallatin County in the early 2000s. Peter and I, as you might say, go back a ways, and I was going to start out by saying, and we've never agreed on anything. Why are you here supporting me? Well, there are two things. I mean, we've talked about managing lawyers. We've talked about training lawyers, which is things that are very difficult to do. You should know it's kind of like herding cats. It's been a long journey. But I think the most outstanding feature of Peter's experience is his experience right at this podium. Justice reinvestment, folks, is revolutionary. It was not a couple of bills that were presented to Senate Judiciary. It was a four-year process, well thought out. Peter and I disagreed about everything. But every one of those discussions was well researched, well thought out, and professionally presented. I wish I could say the same about me. Those are very controversial issues. I don't think, I was just searching my memory, I don't think you will have ever had a candidate for judge in front of this committee who has as much legislative experience as Judge Oman. Maybe Judge Newman in Butte, because he was a legislator. But other than that, as far as respecting the process, understanding the process, participating in the process, you've relied on his opinion and his positions for years. And I think you should confirm him and give him the job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Spencer, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bruce Spencer today representing the State Bar of Montana, in glad support of Judge Oman to be confirmed. You know, as a former president of the State Bar, I have opportunity to hear from many lawyers. And you've heard from the criminal bar in Bozeman, but I have heard from the civil bar. I've heard from plaintiff's lawyers, civil defense lawyers, insurance defense lawyers, and lawyers that don't practice in those areas but that practice in the civil area of law. And all of them strongly recommend the judge for confirmation. You know, in Montana, we're a little unique. We're different than the federal system. You get to actually see the judge in action on the bench before you have a confirmation hearing. And I don't think you're going to hear, you know, opponents that he's acted inappropriately or that he's a bad judge or that he's done things wrong. And those, of course, are absolutely legitimate reasons to be concerned about a nomination. You're not going to hear those. And the reason is he's an excellent judge, and that's why the State Bar strongly supports him. I know that Ed McLean, not Ed McLean, Ed Bartlett, in earlier confirmation hearings, pointed out to you that our judicial system doesn't have a lot of reserves if we don't have enough judges on the benches. We don't have enough retired judges to handle the caseload. We need active judges on our benches. And that's true in this case. I think you heard one of the witnesses in the criminal context indicate cases would get dismissed. Well, in the civil context, cases will just languish. And there is no backstop, I'm afraid. The court system simply doesn't have one. So we don't feel there's any legitimate reason, and I think you've heard today there's many, many excellent reasons to confirm the judge, and we strongly urge you to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spence. And further proponents in the room? Seeing none, we'll go to online. And those of you online, try to be as brief as you can. We have three other bills to hear this morning and a limited amount of time to do it in. So I'm not going to put time limits, but if I have to, I may halfway through. So be as brief as you can. First proponent, Kelson Young.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Kelson Young with the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We rise in support of this nomination. I'm here both in that capacity and personally. There certainly seems to be a theme for the morning, which is to know Peter Omen is to agree to disagree at times. And that's certainly something I actually really value about our relationship. I've known Peter for probably the last, or sorry, I should say Judge Omen. Sorry, Peter. I've known Judge Omen for probably the last decade, and as you've heard from others, he has extensive policy experience, and so as survivors of crime, we show up in many of the same places as other members of the system. I was thinking when some of the prosecutors were speaking that victims of crime are like the fourth leg of that table, that stool. And so certainly there have been times while representing the needs of defendants that we have had chances to disagree, but actually I really do want to concur with so much of the testimony that from my experience, Judge Omen has a robust understanding of the multi-dimensions of the criminal justice system. In addition, Judge Omen was serving on the Montana Board of Crime Control for the last few years and as the chair of that board. And as members of this committee know, the Montana Board of Crime Control is very important to victims of crime and their organizations that serve them. And we found that Judge Omen was very respectful, very understanding, and committed to making sure that the system across the state is robust as well. I heard your request, Senator Espin, so I'll keep it short. I do want to say that I would echo my testimony from the other day about the overburden on the court system and the results of that overburden, and as you've heard in Gallatin County, especially on dependent neglect cases, on domestic violence cases, on other cases where people are waiting for justice. So in addition to Judge Omen being a great candidate and now a great judge, we do think that it's important to maintain the consistency in the system in Gallatin County, and so we'd ask you to support this nomination. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Young. Sydney Berry, please.
Sydney Berry will not be online today.
Alejandra Griffith.
Thank you. My name is Alana Griffith, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H. Thank you, committee. I appreciate the ability to be here by Zoom. I'm in Big Sky, Montana, and I was born and raised in Bozeman. I was actually the District Court 1 law clerk in 2002 as a baby attorney, and Peter was with the Public Defender's Office. Sorry, Peter, Judge Omen. My experience is quite a bit different than a lot of the people you've heard from. I'm a civil attorney. I'm that rare person out there who's not in criminal, who's testifying today. I represent clients in Yellowstone County, Cascade County, Flathead County, Ravalli County, Missoula County, and Park, Gallatin, and Madison counties. And I represent developers. I represent business people. I represent people in construction. all of whom are developing in Gallatin County. And you heard Judge McElyea reference the fact that we are down approximately 3 judges. And it's my clients, the business people, who are most affected by this because it's our cases that aren't being heard. I ask you today to appoint, to confirm or recommend the confirmation of Judge Omen. He is an extremely popular choice, not just from the bar, but also within the business community. And I think it's important that we have the third judge seated so that our cases are at least heard as fast as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Griffith. Ms. Jackson, please.
She's not online, Mr. Chairman.
Ian McIntosh.
Thank you, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Ian McIntosh, McIntosh. I'm a civil defense attorney with the Crowley Fleck Law Firm. First of all, thank you for allowing me to testify again. Last week, I had the honor of testifying in favor of Senate Bill 251, the bill to eliminate phantom damages in civil litigation, a bill that I helped author. I've known Judge Omen for more than 20 years now, and I am confident that Judge Omen will make an excellent district court judge. Judge Omen's appointment should be confirmed for a host of reasons. First of all, Judge Omen will not be an activist judge. He will interpret the law as written by the legislature. He won't make new law. He knows that a district court judge's job is to call balls and strikes, not to rewrite the rules. Judge Omen will also make an excellent district court judge because he's been in the trenches. He has tried jury trials. He knows what it's like to appear in front of a judge in a tough case. He knows the rules of evidence. And as a lawyer, he appeared before both good judges and not so good judges. He knows that all attorneys and litigants just want a judge to treat both parties fairly and interpret the law as written, and that is exactly what Judge Omen will do. Finally, Judge Omen will make an excellent district court judge because, as you have heard, he's a humble person. A humble judge follows the law as enacted by the legislature, even if he might not personally agree with it. A humble judge treats the parties before him with respect and dignity. Judge Omen will follow the law as written, he will be fair to all litigants, and he will treat all parties before him with respect and dignity. For these reasons and the reasons stated by the other proponents, I respectfully request that Judge Omen's appointment be confirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Al Smith, and thank you all for being so brief so far. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Al Smith, Montana Trialers Association. And I would just note that there aren't many things that Mr. McIntosh and I agree upon, but this is certainly one. What we want are judges that are qualified, competent, have a good judicial temperament, and that are efficient and hardworking so that those of us that have civil clients, whether it's individuals or businesses, so that we can get our day in court. Any interruption in service to the people of Gallatin County or the 18th Judicial District is not called for in this case. We have a judge that's demonstrated he knows how to do the job, and we urge that you confirm his appointment. Thank you.
Thank you. Marty Lambert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marty Lambert, L-A-M-B-E-R-T. I've written a letter in support of Judge Omen. I won't go through all the details of that letter, but I hope you've had the opportunity to read it. When Judge Omen described himself or said, I will bring 3 things to the bench, humility, hard work, and he will stay in his lane. I've known Judge Omen for a long time. He is a great example of all 3 of those virtues. I think he's got tremendous ability. He's already proven, as you have heard, that he's an outstanding judge. Please vote to confirm him in committee, and when this matter gets to the floor, please vote to confirm him as district judge here in Bozeman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. We do have your letter. Thank you. Next up, Andrew Bruner.
Chairman, Senators, good morning. My name is Andrew Bruner, B-R-E-U-N-E-R. I am here this morning in support of the confirmation of Judge Peter Oman. I've been an attorney for 27 years. I have served as the city judge for the city of Belgrade for the last 6 years. I have known Judge Oman for 17 years. He has been a friend, colleague, and mentor. He has graciously come to numerous courts of limited jurisdiction judicial conferences over the years, where he is a popular and respected presenter. Prior to becoming a judge, I served with Governor Gianforte on a 5-member board of a private Christian school for over 3 years. During that time, I believe I came to understand the high standards the governor set and expected from those who work within and for our school. I think that it is fitting that Judge Oman squarely meets those high standards. He is a man of impeccable integrity. He possesses a high legal IQ. He's an outdoorsman. He takes his role as a father and the importance of family very seriously. Like justices of the peace, district judges are trial judges who take on the laboring oar of our justice system. They are managers of a complex courtroom operation with many moving parts. Their dockets are full, diverse, and demanding. Their role is to make decisions and move on competently and efficiently. Judge Oman possesses a unique skill set based on experience, humility, and professional relationships fostered over many years. Judge Peter Oman is a true gentleman. All of those qualities together produce that thing we call good judicial temperament. It is not learned or developed over time. Judges come to the bench with it or not. It is, frankly, virtually impossible to replace. Judge Oman has it. Our community is very fortunate to have him on the bench. I urge the committee to support his confirmation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Next up, Greg Todd. You need to unmute yourself, Judge Todd. There you go.
Thank you. My name is Greg Todd, T-O-D-D. I'm a district judge in Billings in the 13th Judicial District. I'm speaking for myself, but I'm also speaking as the president of the Montana Judges Association. I'm in my 21st year as a judge. I remember with mixed emotions that I was in the seat that Judge Oman has now and the other two candidates that appeared on Wednesday. 20 years ago, I had been nominated by and selected by Judge Roscoe to fill the seat in Yellowstone County, and I was appropriately grilled by the committee, and I respect the process. I was confirmed, and I appreciate that. I've continued to serve. I believe Judge Oman, and I know Judge Oman, is certainly qualified. He's a hard worker. He's hit the ground running. He's fair. I don't believe you've heard any witness today. You certainly didn't hear any witnesses on Wednesday opposing these judges. He has across-the-board support, as you've heard, and a whole variety of people in the legal system. There's no reason to reject him. It's no coincidence that the needs in Gallatin, Cascade, Lewis, and Clark are so high. If he were rejected, if Judge Oman were rejected, it would spew chaos in the legal system. It would be at least a 4-month gap before a replacement could be named. And Gallatin County or any of these other counties that would bear the brunt of that would, as you have heard, have substantial problems in a whole variety of cases. I have heard from many of my colleagues. I have heard from attorneys that have also tried cases with or against Judge Oman. They echo the sentiments that you have heard. And so I wholeheartedly, on behalf of myself and the Judges Association, urge the confirmation and of Judge Oman. I would thank you and ask if I could be excused, as I've got some folks waiting in the courtroom. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them right now.
Are there any questions for Judge Todd? Seeing none, you're excused, Judge Todd. Next.
Thank you.
Next up, Judge Holly Brown.
Good morning, Chairman S. and the committee. My name is Judge Holly Brown, B-R-O-W-O. I am the reason you're here today. I'm the district court judge that retired from Department 1 in Gallatin County last fall, and I am joining in the request to have this committee forward Senate Resolution 47 to the Senate floor. I did also send a letter previously to Chairman Regeer, and hopefully you have received that. I was appointed in 2004 to the Department 1 in the 18th Judicial District by then Governor Judy Martz. I also went through this, I didn't go through the confirmation process with the Senate because the timing was such that I had went directly to the election process. I have, however, had the pleasure of serving with both Judge John Brown and Judge Rianne MacLier, who went through the same confirmation process, and we embrace that and respect the work that you are doing today for Judge Oman. I don't want to repeat what's in my letter, but I do wish to add that there are a lot of additional responsibilities that the district court judges have, not only those in court and litigation. There are numerous administrative, committee, and community obligations that go with the job. As you have heard now repeatedly, Judge Oman has solid experience in all of these areas. He has exhibited the demeanor and work ethic to take on these extra opportunities, and I think he will do well with all of the committees, working with law enforcement in particular, and water, which has always been one of my favorite things. As you heard, historically in the 18th Judicial District, one of the specific responsibilities for Department 1, which is my department, and now Judge Oman's, has been the water, including working with our water users, appointing the Water Commission, and working with the Dike and Drain Districts. I think we have the only two fully functioning Dike and Drain Districts in the state. And that's a very unique set of statutes. It's not been modified since 1926, and so it takes some work and creativity to make sure that those districts have what they need and that the water commissioners in general have the support for the jobs that they need to do. Working with the water users through potential disputes in a positive and timely manner is an essential component of having the good relationship that we enjoy on the Gallatin, Willow Creek, and the Dike and Drain districts. Judge Oman is experienced, as you've heard, in some water. He was very excited to get to know more about it. And as he already mentioned, he, within days of taking office, took the opportunity to get his feet wet, let's say, and go through the multiple irrigation canals and head gates with our head water commissioner, George Alberta. We have all worked hard to maintain a strong relationship and bond with each other and our community, and particularly working with community members, business members, the Chamber of Commerce, and our agricultural and other water users. And in conjunction with the other observations that I noted in my letter, I request your support for Senate Resolution 47 and forward that resolution to confirm Judge Oman to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Brown. We do have your letter. We also have letters from some of those coming up yet. So summarize, if you can, we we'll go now to Judge Mike. And you tell me who you are, sir.
Chairman S, that's fine. That happens all the time. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I am Mike Salvani, and that is spelled S-A-L-V-A-G-N-I. The G is silent. It's Italian.
Thank you, sir. Proceed.
I am a retired district court judge from Gallatin County. For 20 years, I served on the bench. I was involved in the creation of the first adult treatment court in Montana's judicial system and presided over that court for 11 years. Before becoming judge, I was the Gallatin County attorney for 14 years. Before that, I had a private legal practice and was also a public defender in Gallatin County for 6 years. I retired in December 2016. With my background, experience, and understanding of being a judge, I appear this morning before you to urge you to approve Senate Resolution 47 for Judge Peter Ullman's confirmation. On Sunday, I sent each of you individually an email stating reasons for supporting Judge Ullman's confirmation. Judge Ullman told you about his career. From my experience as a judge for 20 years, I want to focus on one aspect of that career. As an attorney, Peter Ullman appeared before me in several cases. For 10 years, he handled juvenile cases that came before me. One thing that always impressed me about him was his thorough preparation in representing those kids. With kids who were found to be delinquent, he was always diligent and resourceful in proposing dispositions that would serve the best interests of the kids and address the need to protect the public. Like with treatment court programs, which provide for opportunities for offenders, he not only advocated for opportunities to give a kid a chance, but also came to court with credible and concrete plans to accomplish that objective. In other words, you might say he went the extra mile. Judge Ullman has brought that kind of experience and perspective to the bench. Today, Judge Ullman sits on the bench in one of the busiest judicial districts in Montana, and you've heard all about that this morning, and it is absolutely true. It was busy 4 years ago, and it's busier today. We needed a fourth district court judge here 4 years ago. Judge Ullman is qualified to continue as judge in this very busy district. As a citizen of Gallatin County, and as a former judge in this county, I am proud to endorse his confirmation. I respectfully encourage you to improve the resolution and send his confirmation with your bipartisan support to the full Senate. I thank you for this time, and I thank you for your service to the state of Montana and the people in Gallatin County.
Thank you, Judge Salvani. Next up, Lars Phillips. Lars, I can pronounce.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lars Phillips. That is P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S. I'm an attorney in Bozeman, Montana, and I'm here in my personal capacity. Judge Ullman is well qualified and, as you've heard, already hard at work. I know that Judge Ullman has been in the office every weekend, except for two.
Could you move just a little closer to your mic, Lars?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And as I was saying, Judge Ullman has demonstrated an extraordinary commitment to public service. Despite these efforts, the delay caused by the sheer volume of cases in the Gallatin County courts is extreme. You've heard from the county attorney why Judge Ullman is good for the criminal docket, and I'm here to echo the comments you've heard that he is good for the civil docket as well. I practice primarily in civil litigation. I routinely counsel my clients that you cannot expect to get through trial in any matter within 3 years in this county. Imagine the effect this delay has on the business interests down here. Gallatin County needs more judges, not fewer. And as Judge MacLeay said this morning, we are at a tipping point. I urge this committee to support the confirmation of Judge Oman. Thank you.
Thank you. Last up, Mr. Matthew House, and we do have your letter, Mr. House. Go ahead.
Can you hear me, Vice Chair?
Yes, very good.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Matthew House, H-A-U-S. I'm sorry I wasn't able to appear in person today. I actually have a deposition that was supposed to begin at 9 a.m. that is on pause right now. I submitted the letter to the committee members on behalf of the board of the Gallatin County Bar.
Mr.
Association. I am currently president of the Gallatin County Bar Association, Oman, to ensure that the... Can you hear me?
You kind of fade in and out, but we're hearing you now.
Okay, sorry. I noticed that the connection was unstable. But we're asking you to confirm Judge Oman to ensure that the 18th Judicial District continues to function under a very large caseload. I want to use today as an opportunity to briefly discuss three matters that were not discussed in the letter from the Board of the Gallatin County Bar Association. The first is that the board is comprised of a variety of attorneys, a prosecutor, criminal defense attorneys, family law attorneys, insurance defense attorneys, and civil litigators. Some of those board members wrote letters of support for Judge Oman, while others supported other applicants. Despite that background, the board was unanimous in asking this committee to confirm the nomination of Judge Oman. The committee should also be aware that Gallatin County attorneys, including myself, spent significant time attempting to recruit applicants for the seat that was vacated by Judge Holly Brown. In the end, only five attorneys applied for the position. Those recruitment efforts would be wasted if Judge Oman is not confirmed, and I am very concerned that an even smaller number of applicants will apply for the position if it is open a second time. Finally, in my practice as a civil lawyer, many of my clients are business owners. The caseload of the 18th Judicial District is regularly factored into decisions that are made by my clients. For example, if a construction company owner is owed money, my clients often have to consider whether to take less than what is owed to them versus waiting several years to receive the full amount. Those decisions and those conversations take place on a weekly and sometimes daily basis when you're consulting clients about whether or not to move forward with litigation. So I am asking you to confirm Judge Oman in order to ensure that the caseload in the 18th Judicial District is not further backlogged. Vice Chair, may I be excused from the remainder of the hearing to return to my deposition?
Any questions for Mr. House from the committee? Seeing none, you are excused.
Thank you.
Are there any further proponents in the room? Seeing none, opponents in the room. Any opponents in the room? None online. Informational witnesses? None online or in the room. Questions from the committee? Senator Manziel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Judge Oman, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Judge Oman. You've got a lot of experience. A lot of experience. That's fantastic. It's a difficult job, obviously, and you've got a very large, heavy workload, and I appreciate what you've said about staying in your own lane. But obviously, we in the legislature do make mistakes on occasion with the statutes that we present you to deal with, and you're the person in the field who's actually practically applying the law. So, in your view, what is the appropriate process for the judicial branch to communicate effectively with the legislative branch to say we need to We need to address this. We need to do it over. We need to correct it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Manzella, so that's a great point, because I've been up here crafting law, and we sit here and we say, well, this is what it means. We all agree. We all know what we mean here. And then we go, it goes out into the community, and then somebody reads it differently. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess you could read it that way. And then there we go. Then the judge has to figure out the differences. I think the best way, and somebody made the comment when I was going through the commission, that given my familiarity with this process and being up at the legislature a bunch, they thought, well, you know, maybe you could go up and let legislators know how things are working in the trenches or on the ground. I guess if there was a statute that I thought might be could be maybe more clarified or something to that extent, I would probably get in touch with the court administrator's office and then just let them know that this is maybe a statute that's confusing to me, or maybe this isn't what it's being interpreted, not the way that the legislature probably wanted it to be interpreted. And to be honest with you, I just looked at the statute yesterday, and it's going through, and I'm not going to say what it is, but I was thinking, I bet you they'd want to add, you know, this clause to that. And that's one of the disadvantages as far as we're here, we're so busy with everything that's going on here, and then you've got this other world who's looking at it over here, and then sometimes the communication isn't so great. So I personally, I'm not here to make policy, but I don't think I would be that hesitant to let folks know that, you know, maybe there's something that would need to be clarified or you know, take another look at, because you can always amend what you've previously put out.
Thank you. I appreciate that explanation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You had mentioned, I believe it was House Bill 133, and that didn't ring any bells for me at the moment, but then Mr. Murphy talked about the justice reinvestment, and that lit it up for me. Sure. And as I recall, that was a suite of bills, was it not?
It was a very comprehensive, Mr. Chair, Senator Manzella, it was a very comprehensive bill. It was not just one issue. There was a lot in it. And justice reinvestment, correct, was a suite of bills.
Okay. And we did a lot of good work on that, but there was a couple issues that we got wrong according to my sheriff. I recall being chewed out for that pretty good. And I'm trying to remember the details, and I'm a little foggy, and I don't know if you can help me with that, but I think one had to do with assault, not removing a sheriff.
I think it was disorderly. There were two, if I may.
Please.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Mantel, the two amendments that I remember that were made was disorderly conduct, in that the law enforcement was concerned that they didn't have an opportunity to arrest somebody who was maybe not committing an assault or committing that kind of crime in a bar, but was getting there. You know, we saw it coming, and that they didn't have a chance to defuse the situation and just take that person and put him in custody for the night until they sobered up or whatever. And so this body amended that so that there was that opportunity to effectuate that arrest in those kind of situations. And the other one was with respect to thefts. And there was testimony presented in the 19th session that there were basically these gangs that were going around Montana and going into stores and taking a bunch of product and running out the emergency door exit, and then knowing that there wasn't any possibility of incarceration because it was below the $1,000, $1,500 threshold. And so the legislature changed that as well to provide that there was incarceration available for those types of offenses. So that's my recollection.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that explanation.
Further question?
Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the judge, please. It sounds like Gallatin County is very short of judges. And in the last two hearings regarding the judges, it seems like it's pervasive throughout the state. Mine is, and I'm just going to keep up my theme, do you have any experience in ICWA cases?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, yes, I have extensive experience in ICWA cases. When I did child welfare cases from 03 to probably 07, 08, 09, we had a lot of ICWA cases, and so I was familiar with them there. I also, when I was a training coordinator, we did ICWA training specifically for our attorneys that were doing those kind of cases, and so I'm very familiar with, and we also, we had a, now of course it's escaping me, but we actually had a training, we had a professor come in from University of Montana that provided a historical context for ICWA and why ICWA came to be because of the removal of Native children from their home back in the 60s and 70s and being placed in out-of-state schools, for lack of a better term, and the need to try to maintain that culture for Indian children and not have them placed outside their culture. So I'm familiar with the reason for ICWA, and then I'm also familiar with the added standards of proof that are required for ICWA in child welfare cases. And I think the most important one, there's many, but I think the most important one to me, particularly as a judge as I'm going through these cases, is that there's a requirement for active efforts on the part of the child welfare worker, as opposed to reasonable efforts when they're trying to work for reunification. And so that just requires that they do more, get more involved, make more phone calls, provide more rides, make a little more of an effort with respect to visitation, all those things to try to get that child reunified with their family or get placed in an appropriate Indian family, hopefully kinship.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Judge Ullman, I have a lot of servicemen in my family. And my son is he's a police officer, but he served in Afghanistan and Iraq. So the veterans are real close to my heart. So what is your experience with veterans that have post-traumatic stress or come home with all of these issues in your court?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, it's always evolving, is what I can say. I've worked with veterans I've worked with veterans as clients while I was doing public defense work. I did specific trainings for our public defenders on how to work with veterans when I was doing the training. And then just a couple of weeks ago, we had a sentencing for a fellow who had a psychotic break, mostly to do with PTSD from his days serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I had a long exchange with him about his service and how that affected not only his criminal situation, but also, which is really, that's obviously a big concern, but also what's going to happen going forward. How are you going to get the treatment that you need? How are you going to get hooked up with services at the VA? What are you going to do so that you don't have this break again? What are the triggers? And then also specifically, what are the kinds of treatments that are going to work for you as a veteran? Because I think they're different than what's going to be provided to a general member of the public. So I can say that my experience has been long-term, and I'm certainly alert to that when I see individuals come in that are veterans, and whether that be in civil cases or criminal cases. And I heard the other day that the VA is considered to be a geriatric healthcare service, but I'm thinking that that might not be the case so much anymore because of all the young people that we have who are now in their 30s and 40s, coming into the system due to the experiences that they had. So, something that I'm very interested in, sensitive to, and continuing to learn about.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the question, Senator Brown, and then Senator McGilvray. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We talked about water commissioners a little bit, and anytime we start talking about water, my ears perk up because I am on the WPIC Water Policy Committee. So I want to chat with you just kind of a little bit about that. If you can expand, I'll kind of give you just all my ideas and just let you go here a little bit. But, if you could expand on, maybe cases that you've heard, dealing with water, and what you feel like the district courts role is in water cases, you know, at this point in time and then possibly post-adjudication?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I thank you for that question. So when I was in law school, the reason I went to the law school I went to is because of their environmental program, and so I got a certificate in environmental law. I thought I'd go out and practice in environmental law, and then it just didn't happen. My career, as you could tell, took me different places. So I do have a bit of a background in that. With respect to the water commissioners, I'm still reading the statutes. I've been, you know, I've read, you know, obviously what the water commissioner's roles are. I've gone out and looked at the ditches and drainages and things of that nature. And I've also, I've been, actually, we've started getting reports now from the two ditch districts that we manage, and then we'll have a public hearing on that in July, if hopefully I'm still around, and so I can learn more there. You know, obviously the water courts deal with the adjudication, and then the district courts potentially deal with conflicts between users. I haven't had a case yet where that has come up where I've had a conflict between users. I do have one case pending now that involves a subdivision and then also involves a water, it's a, you know, water and sewer district. And so so I have something else that Judge Holly Brown taught me was, you know, just deal with the cases as they come in and then when you have to deal with them. Because if you start thinking about some case that 6 months from now, you're not going to be able to address the cases that need to be addressed right away. So I haven't looked at that case that closely yet. And so I guess, unfortunately, I don't know that I'm the best person to have a good conversation with about that. But I would hope that if I had the chance in 4 or 5 months, we could have a really interesting conversation. And I think I would have learned a lot more because, you know, I came on in October and we haven't even really started the irrigation season yet. And so my expectation is that come probably May or June is when I would do the appointments for the water commissioners. And then we would, then, you know, if issues came up then where there were conflicts and the court needed to get involved, then I would get involved with that. Like I said, I think if we can manage those informally, then that's great. It saves everybody money and, you know, it saves emotions and everything like that that comes around from coming into court. But if not, then they would come to court and then we would try to, we would adjudicate those and have hearings and take evidence and go through the normal court process.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Further question, Senator McGillivray. And Judge Ullman, the camera's right on top of that laptop.
Right, so I won't be turning around.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume you can hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Judge, for coming today and appreciate your experience and work ethics and desire to stay in your lane. I do have some questions on some constitutional provisions. And I'm particularly concerned about Article 2 and the Declaration of Rights in the Constitution. In Article 2, Section 3, it talks about the right to a clean and healthful environment, but also the right to pursue life basic necessities. I want to apply that to the recent pandemic where there seemed to be some tension between, quarantines and so forth, and people that were considered non-essential workers were not allowed to pursue life's basic necessities. As a judge, what are your feelings about the tension between those two and how would you balance them?
Mr. Chair, Senator McGillivray, great question. I'll tell you what, I had never given public health a second thought until all of this came up. And to be honest with you, I thought that, I think that there's been the litigation up in the Flathead, and then there was a case down in our district, but I thought there was going to be a lot more litigation about this. I thought that we'd see some criminal charges for people not doing what they're supposed to be doing. I thought we'd see more civil pushback from, like you say, business communities or individuals. I'm glad that we haven't seen that much, and I'm optimistic that we're going to, you know, be done with this thing here in the near future, and then these can be academic conversations as opposed to real-world conversations. I think you understand that I can't comment on how I might rule on an issue because it'd be considered an advisory opinion, but I also don't want to shortchange you and think that I'm dodging a question. And so I would just do what I do in all these cases. I would just try to balance it. I would look at the constitutional provisions that apply. I'd look at the statutory provisions that apply. I'd look at the timing of those provisions. I think there's a good amount of legislation that's coming out on that and clarifying that and maybe moving that responsibility from unelected officials to elected officials, which makes sense to me. That's one thing that, and I'm going off here, but that's one thing when I came out of this position, the responsibility that you feel as an elected official to your constituents in this kind of position is really strong. It's something that I'd never experienced before because I'd never been there. But it's the responsibility is new to me, and so that's also kind of a learning process. So, Senator, my default, just so you know, is individual rights, and then I go from there. And so that's probably where I would start, is I would be thinking about the individual's rights. And then I would be having, obviously, to perhaps weigh that with the other interests that were involved. But just so you know, that's where I start my determinations, and or that's where I start my thought process. And then from there, I look obviously, like you said, Article 2, Section 3. There's a lot of other subsections in there that might apply as well. I'd look at the statute, see if there's anything on point there, and then obviously I would go to case law and work on the case. So that's how I would approach it. I don't know where I'd end up, but that's how I'd start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd have another question on a different section in that article.
Go ahead.
Article 5 talks about the state shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So do you see any limits to the state there, or do you see any laws that you think are valid to restrict or abrogate someone's freedom of religion or prohibit them from exercising, like, for example, that happened during the pandemic when churches were essentially shut down?
Right. So, Mr. Chair, Senator McGillivray, I would hope not. That's our history. That's our culture, you know. But like I said, too, that, you know, this whole public health thing is kind of new to me. I know the Supreme Court weighed in on that, and I think one of the salient points that they made was that it seemed that there was a disparate kind of treatment between people's right to gather and to exercise their religion compared to somebody's right to, like, I don't know, go to a health club or go out to eat or something like that. And so I can't imagine why if you could go out and do those things with respect to commerce, you wouldn't be able to do something that is extremely personal and private and then also fundamental to your rights under both the state constitution and obviously the U.S. Constitution as well. Again, I can't tell you how I would rule because I don't have everything in front of me and I can't do an advisory opinion. But obviously, you know, like you said, it's in the Constitution. It's in there for a reason. And so I would obviously try to put it into effect as much as possible.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And also one more section in this article, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
One more, yes.
And then I have one other question, Mr. Chairman. But this goes back to the right to keep and bear arms. And I think someone said, as we were looking at some of these bills that have made their way through the legislature, that a nefarious person has the ability to carry that someone should have the right to carry a concealed weapon. And do you see, again, I know you can't comment on any specific case, but can just comment generally to that.
It was a little... I didn't hear everything maybe perfectly, but sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator McGillivray. I think what I heard was a question about the right to carry concealed and then right to carry concealed in the legislature.
No, let me just clarify that, Mr. Chairman. I asked, as bills were working through the legislature, we heard that one slogan, if you will, If a nefarious person has the ability to carry, then a citizen of Montana should have the right to carry. And I'm specifically applying this to defending life, liberty, and property. And do you see any limits to that right called a castle doctrine to defend property and liberty and person as that 12th section of Article 2 would suggest.
All right. So thanks, Senator. And so, Mr. Chair, Senator McGilvery, you know the situation with advisory opinions. I can't provide one. One thing is Montana has the right to own firearms, and Montana is extremely explicit. All right, I mean it's in there, and so but I would also have to say that, and this is a rule of every constitutional rights. There's limits to every constitutional right. There's limits to free speech, privacy. Everywhere there's a limit. I have a friend, and he says everybody should be able to own a tank, you know. And so, I don't know, maybe everybody should be able to own a tank, but that would be an interesting case to hear. So I think carrying concealed makes perfect sense. I actually just got a case yesterday where there was a challenge to on a denial of a concealed carry permit. And so we have a process. I absolutely respect the culture of Montana. It's a gun-toting culture, and if I wasn't okay with that, I'd move somewhere else.
One last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGilvery, go ahead. Just keep in mind that the real chairman is starting to glare at me. So
I understand our time frames, but this is very important too, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
So I just have to ask one more question. The legislature, particularly the House, has the power of impeachment. And I don't know the history of the legislature, they've ever impeached a judge, but can you think of a case or a reason, or what would rise in your mind to the level of impeachment of a judge by the Montana House?
Mr. Chair, Senator McGilvery, I think obviously quid pro quos, doing something for somebody else to with respect to a certain ruling. I think misconduct in the employment workplace. I think that might be appropriate some places. Obviously, corruption, and then also, as you know, you can define these things. And so, if you want to define it more explicitly as to what would be a level or what would be conduct that would constitute impeachment, then anything there. But those are just a couple of things that spring to mind. I would expect there would be many more, but those are the kind of examples that would come to the front of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Judge Ullman. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Judge, for coming in. Senator, would you like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this committee is well aware of there is lawyer talk and there's lay talk. I don't know whether you caught it. One of the proponents said that Judge Ullman would make a good judge because he has a criminal background. I'm sure they meant criminal law background. So I'd like to thank all those that came to testify and Judge Ullman for coming. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. We will soon open the hearing on House Bill 463, I suspect, but
do we have a representative here? Seen any Trevis or?
I have not seen Trevis. I don't. What's Derek out here waiting for?
Sullivan.
Derek's been out here waiting for a long time.
Derek?
No, Derek. From the AG's office.
Paris Olson. Oh, good.
I thought I caught a glimpse, maybe a Katie out there.
I'll take a 5-minute recess. A witness looks like.
I'm going to have to run the rest. Oh, that's not Katie.
It is half cold.
It's cold. I'm cold.
Perfect in here.
It's super comfy here.
Yeah. And for For me, it's perfect in this room right now, too.
Senator Mazzella has a nice hat on.
In honor of Lola Galloway's mother.
Yeah. Oh, there he is.
Oh, there he is.
Okay. Right.
Committee, we found a sponsor. So we will open the hearing on House Bill 463. Representative, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll try to make this shorter than the last hearing. Let's see. So I'm Jeremy Trebus, House District 26 in Great Falls, bringing to you Bill number 463 today. Close that out. It's pretty easy. The title says an act revising the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, and the main part of this is decreasing the amount of time before an institution may release or modify a restriction on a gift instrument. So, catch my breath here a minute, I had to run up the stairs. the summary of this, then, is to change section 72-30-2074, in Montana Code. It's an important provision of the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, or the UMP or UPMIFA, that allows a charitable institution the authority to seek a release or modification of a charitable fund under limited circumstances. Unfortunately, under our current statute, if an institution determines that the original mission and donative intent the charitable fund becomes, among other things, impracticable, impossible to achieve, or wasteful, the charitable fund nevertheless remains trapped within the institution for 20 years before the institution has the authority to seek a release or modification of the fund. In many instances, 20 years is simply far too long to wait while the charitable fund remains unable to achieve its charitable purpose and dissipates and wastes away due to administrative costs and overhead. So in most instances, a charitable fund is established to address a current charitable need. If the charitable need has not changed, but the funding channel is unable to address those needs, the donated funds remain trapped for two decades, which does not serve the intent of the donor nor the charitable purpose of the fund. The proposed amendment simply shortens that timeline as the drafters of the model bill being one that's generally crafted for states to adopt, should they choose, nationwide, there's these models, hence the name Uniform Act, different types of those sorts of acts. This shortens that timeline while still protecting original donor intent and still subjecting the decision to the scrutiny of the Montana Attorney General. The two proposed amendments accomplish the following. Instead of waiting 20 years, institution can, after 12 years, notify the Montana Attorney General and redirect those funds through channels that does achieve the original donor intent. The drafting committee of the UPMIFA specifically recognized that the number of years can be reduced by the enacting jurisdiction, which would be Montana in this case, stating, of course, if the Attorney General has concerns, he or she can seek the agreement of the charity to change or abandon the modification, and if that fails, can commence a court action to enjoin it. Thus, in all types of modification, the Attorney General continues to be the protector both of the donor's intent and of the public's interest in charitable funds. Thus, the Montana Attorney General remains the important safeguard to ensure that the institution uses the charitable funds in a manner consistent with the charitable purpose of the funds. So, let's see, finally, to ensure that the institution always uses the property in a manner consistent with the charitable purposes expressed in the gift instrument, this wording has been moved into the governing paragraph of subsection 4 to ensure that it applies to both subsection 4A relating to small institutional funds and subsection 4B relating to older institutional funds. And I'll sit down and we can talk about it more. Thanks.
Any proponents in the room?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think I got the microphone high enough.
Yep. You'll have to bend down a little.
Yes. Derek A. Stryker, OESTREICHER, General Counsel at the Attorney General's Office. This is a good bill. It's a simple bill. All the things you need to pay attention to are on page 2. As a good representative was saying, we changed 20-year requirement back to 12. One of the things that I really appreciated about this bill is if you take a look at the old language, we had a list there at the end on page 2. And in that list, A, B, and C, we had an or and an and. Now that is like nails on a chalkboard to an attorney. It creates ambiguity. We've cleaned that up in this bill, and you can rest easy. That's no longer an issue. So green light on this bill. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents in the room? Seeing none, online, David Bell.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Bell, last name B-E-L-L. I'm the CEO of ALPS, which is the largest insurer of lawyers malpractice on a direct basis in the country. We're the only Montana-based insurance company that writes nationally, insuring more than 20,000 lawyers and law firms from coast to coast, all done right here in our great state of Montana. More relevant to the issue this morning, I'm also the co-founder and president of an organization called Grateful Nation Montana. And we provide up to a 4-year full ride education, room board books, tutoring, mentoring for all 38 children of our 43 boys who have given their lives for our country in service in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have funding that has been raised, but the ability to get some of these funds into the hands of these children of our fallen Montana men and women in uniform has been frustrated by the current statute. The bill fixes those areas. I'd be happy to answer questions from the committee about the particulars if you're interested, but I do appreciate the opportunity to testify as a proponent of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no more proponents, are there opponents in the room? None online, informational witnesses? Seeing none, none online, questions from the committee? Senator S.
Mr. Chairman, I do not have a question. I just wanted to acknowledge Mr. Bell, and his firm used to employ someone very close to me, and I appreciated that.
Okay, so noted. Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for, I don't know how to say Derek's last name.
Spell it again for us.
OESTREI. CHER. Of course, it's pronounced just like it's spelled, A. Stryker.
Okay. Mr. A. Stryker, thank you. I'm just wondering how the years 20 and 12, how did we arrive at those numbers? They both seem excessive to me. But
well, I think, you know, when you're dealing with the, I'm sorry, through the chair, Mr. Okay. Chair, Senator Menzel, and when you're dealing with a gift like that, you want to have, I think the important part here ultimately is that the Attorney General has oversight. You don't want to have someone give a gift and then immediately change the purpose of that gift. So you want to have that time, that passage of time. Of course, these numbers come from a Uniform Act, so we'd have to go back and figure out who came up with the 20-year. You know, I understand that probably Mr. Bell might have a better answer in terms of the 12 years, how that was arrived at, but ultimately our concern at Department of Justice is that we have oversight and we can challenge if we don't think that that change in the instrument is proper. Thank you.
Senator McGilvery.
Mr. Chairman, question for Mr. A. Stryker.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
We had a bill by Representative Mercer. It was a decanter, and I think it was a Uniform Act, and you're probably familiar with it. This sounds a lot. If this sounds familiar, is it to be coordinated with that bill, or are we doing something different here?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe, and I forgive me, I'm not sure the House bill number off the top of my head. There's so many. But that bill that you are referencing with Representative Mercer is the Uniform Trust Decanter Act. I believe that bill deals with situations in which irrevocable trusts, the trust rests, is put into another irrevocable trust, completely different situation than House Bill 463.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
Does 463, is it dealing with trusts, or is it some other instrument that we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, it is dealing with trust, but I believe Representative Mercer's bill is a different type of trust.
Okay.
Rather than the types of trusts that we're dealing with here. Charitable.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Sands.
Mr. Chairman, a question for the sponsor. Mr. Chairman, thank you for this bill. I worked for a while for the Montana Community Foundation. Are these the kinds of, they have, as you know, hundreds and hundreds of different gifts that have been given to them to hold for all kinds of specific purposes. Does this bill apply to them? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sands, I would think so, but I'm not absolutely sure. And just to clarify the type of trust this has to do with charitable funds, which is what we're talking about now.
Correct.
Which is different than what would be like an individual or maybe like an estate type deal, which is outside my ballpark.
So. Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Yeah, those funds that go to them are creating all kinds of donor funds for specific purposes. I'll give them a call and find out since you have not heard from them, I assume, at all.
Correct. I have not.
And a follow-up, could you tell me who came in to testify then on behalf of this bill in the House? Was there a bigger crowd than we have here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sands, same crew, same folks.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, pretty simple bill. It does come from a Uniform Act that the state adopted. As to the history of 20 and 12 and the numbers, I'm not exactly sure, but I think as Mr. A. Stryker, I always want to call him Ostricher, but A. Stryker, I'll try to remember that, said it's still under the purview of the Attorney General to determine whether or not a change in purpose for funds that were donated for a specific purpose is appropriate or not. So still under his, as the Attorney General, their purview. And really the point of this is just to make sure that the purpose can be changed sooner if that's the right thing to do so that the funds are being put to good use. And that's it. Thank you.
This ends the hearing on House Bill 463.
Yeah, but carry your own. Carry different than anybody else.
Oh. Committee, we're having a tough time getting representatives here.
Mr. Chairman, both the sponsors are on Zoom.
Well, they are.
There you go.
Oh, there I see one. Okay. Good. Representative Sullivan, there you go. You're off mute. Okay. Are you ready?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 479. Representative, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I'm glad to be here in Senate Judiciary today. My name is Katie Sullivan. I am representing Missoula's House District 89, and today I bring House Bill 479, which is the third-party data privacy bill. My goal with this bill is to require a warrant prior to the request of third-party electronic data. And I do believe there are some physical handouts in the room that I gave to the secretary earlier, and I think, Mr. Chair, can those be handed out?
We'll get them, yes.
Great. And I will go ahead and email those to the online senators today as well. So what is third-party data? This is the data and information that you store with a third party, so another business. These are documents you store on the cloud. This is the online footprint that you leave, such as messages on your social media profile. And with this bill, we are updating our code to make it clear that a warrant is required before a government agency requests this information. Former Representative Daniel Zolnikov helped us provide privacy protections for location data, stored data, and transmitted data. And this is just adding another component to his previous work to make sure this now third-party or cloud information is also covered. And so I'm going to quickly review the bill. I'm going to start, though, with Section 2, if you're looking at it. This is where we are updating the code for search warrants or investigative subpoenas. In this section, we are adjusting the language a bit to include data communicated, stored, held, or maintained, or transmitted by an electronic communication service. So this is the language that's the third-party cloud information. You will see, though, that in Section 2, we are carving out, so warrants are not required for what we are now calling subscriber information. And so, what is subscriber information? You have to go up to Section 1 into the definitions, and you will see that this is stuff like your name, your address, the duration of time you've spent with a service provider, the type, your telephone number, and things like that. We are not requiring a warrant for this subscriber information because this is the information used to confirm that law enforcement is serving the warrant on the correct business. We don't want to make it so it's they have to serve warrants on bunches of companies, wasting their time, wasting the company's time looking for the right person. So we're going to let them ask before they serve the warrant, hey, is this the right person that we are serving on? Are we serving this on the right company? And so we're going to go ahead and carve out that subscriber information from the warrant requirement. And then going back to Section 2, here you're going to see some amendments that have previously been worked out by the stakeholders. So you'll see some amendments from the House side. Starting with sub 2 of Section 2, this clause protects, or the intention of the clause is to protect the innocent person caught up in a large data sweep from a third-party provider. So it's saying law enforcement can't use this information if the person's not subject to the warrant. But you'll hear from opponents today that this language needs to be struck in an amendment that I have already drafted because it is just not clear enough at this time for it to move forward. And so I have spoken with the stakeholders as well as the co-sponsors on this bill, and we all agree to go ahead and strike that language of sub 2. But we will keep the remaining parts, which you'll see sub 3 means law enforcement must delete the information when they're done using it so that it is no longer somewhere someone can access it. And number 4, this bill doesn't apply to the information for folks in our correction system because they've kind of lost that right to privacy for the time being, and that information, their third-party data, is looked at and monitored. And we want to make sure that we aren't interfering with that. So that's the entirety of the bill. I'm going to sit back and let some proponents and opponents speak. And please check out, if you have your packet, you'll see on page 3 the suggested amendment, which basically just strikes the entirety of sub 2, section 2. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any proponents in the room? Proponents to the room.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kendall Cotton, Cotton spelled C-O-T-T-O-N. I am the president and CEO of the Frontier Institute. We're a nonprofit think tank based right here in Helena, and we're pleased to offer our support for this bill today. We think that HB 479 brings some important updates to our Montana's protections from mass collection, mass surveillance of its citizens. You might remember, as part of the revelations brought forward by Edward Snowden back several years ago, you know, we found out that while court approval was needed to begin a surveillance project, what was happening was they were then collecting everything, and then they were storing it indefinitely, and then searching it with very little oversight at will, without really any supervision. And so we think that this bill, you know, helps protect Montanans from that Orwellian scenario by requiring that any data that's picked up must be disposed of in a timely manner when the investigation concludes. We don't think the government should be able to just engage in mass collection and then just keep all of your data forever. We think that protections for mass surveillance are especially important this year because, you know, in the last year we've seen public trust deteriorate. And a lot of people are very concerned about data collection. The Frontier Institute actually conducted a poll in, last October. We found that 65% of Montanans said that they wanted more protections from government mass surveillance and assurances about how their private info was collected, stored, and shared. And this was true for libertarians, Democrats, Republicans, people of all stripes. So we think that lawmakers ought to listen to those Montanans and extend more privacy protections for their digital data. We encourage your support. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Katjana Stutzer, K-A-T-J-A-N-A, S-T-U-T-Z-E-R. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Public Interest Research Group, or MONTPERG, and we rise in support of House Bill 479. As the sponsor explained, and for all the reasons that you've already heard today, we think that privacy is certainly a value that is in the interest of all Montanans. I would add that most privacy policies, when we're using these third-party platforms, include consent to transfer of data to third parties. But in both our U.S. and Montana Constitution, we protect info where there is a reasonable expectation of privacy. When we're using Facebook and when our data is going to the cloud or in our email archives, we're not expecting that that data is going to be shared with anyone. So I think most people have the expectation that that data is going to be private and contain sensitive information that they wouldn't want just anybody to have access to. But Pew Research in 2019 showed that only 9% of folks read those privacy policies when you check that you're going to use Facebook and have access to their messaging services. And only 22% of the 9% that even read it said that they read all of it. And only 8% say, of those who even read it, say that they understood all of it. So even though law enforcement might be going about this in the right way, we know that Montanans expect that data to be private and not shared with anyone, and that also both the U.S. and the Montana Constitution would align with that expectation that that data would stay private. So we feel that it is important to enshrine this in law. Clearly, privacy is a priority this session. We've already seen several bipartisan efforts to address this issue, and we would urge a due pass on HB 479 in the spirit of that value. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kriegel. That's K-R-I-E-G-E-L. I'm with Americans for Prosperity. We stand in support of HB 479. We appreciate the bipartisan effort behind this bill. We believe it draws a bright red line on what data should be retained. That's part of the warrant and what is personal and irrelevant to the warrant. We are all for reducing our digital blueprint. We do appreciate the amendments that have been attached to this bill and the one that's proposed to allow data from those who are incarcerated to be retained and to allow data of other criminal activity that has been collected that may not be specifically a part of the scope of the warrant. We think these two amendments are important to the bill, and for these reasons, we do support and urge a do pass on HB 479. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anya Wookie Huffman. That's spelled A-N-J-A-W-O-O-K-E-Y hyphen H-U-F-F-M-A-N, and I am testifying on my own behalf. I have been working as an intern with Representative Sullivan since January, and during that time, I have come to recognize the holes in the Montana Code that challenge the clarity of our constitutional right to privacy in regards to electronic information that is stored by third parties. Yes, protections do currently exist, but it's easy to forget how those protections come up short. Messages saved across social media, documents and images stored in the cloud, even emails sitting in our inboxes are forms of electronic communications that are stored by third parties, that we all interact with daily, and that the current Montana Code does not define as being a part of electronic communications in a way that guarantees that law enforcement agencies will be required to have a warrant to access this information. As the body of data that's stored by outside parties continues to grow, it continues to produce a more complete story of who we are as individuals, making our lives easier, but also potentially less secure. If the practices of law enforcement already align with the standards set in this bill to protect electronic communications data stored by third parties, then this bill is not redundant. It just shows that the way we are doing things is right and that they need to continue in the same way in the future without question. As Katiana mentioned, a 2019 Pew Research survey found that only 8% of U.S. adults say they fully understand the privacy policies of companies when they agree to them. The Montana State Constitution requires that the right to privacy shall not be infringed upon unless a compelling state interest can be shown. So regardless of whether or not Montanans understand the privacy policies that companies produce, we should be confident that the compelling state interest is being shown before our stored electronic communications data is shared by third parties. It's for these reasons that I urge the committee to pass House Bill 479. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents in the room? There are none online. We'll go to opponents in the room.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Brian Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of two organizations. That would be the Montana County Attorneys Association, as well as the Montana Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. And we oppose this bill as it's currently drafted. I'd like to begin by saying that Representative Sullivan has spent a lot of time with me specifically working on this bill, discussing our issues. And as she discussed, an amendment striking subsection 2 of section 2 of the bill will cause our opposition to be withdrawn. With that being in mind, I still do want to walk you through this bill, walk you through the privacy interests and the many of the arguments of the proponents to make sure that you guys really understand this and what its impact would be if it were not amended. And so let's frame, first of all, what realm we're talking about. We're talking about electronic communications as defined in 46-5-601, and then those that are stored by a third-party provider. So specifically, this is going to be limited to not your cell phone. Yeah, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about the information that's maybe on your personal computer. That's not what we're talking about. That's not what this bill has any applicability to. What we're talking about is your like Facebook Messenger that's maintained by Facebook. So we're talking about the relationship between law enforcement and Facebook. What's their ability to go to Facebook and say, hey, can I get the messages exchanged between Brian and this other person? That's what the bill is addressing, and nothing more. The primary concern that we have with the bill is going to be on page 2 and the very top of page 3. And that language is, you know, a governmental entity may only require disclosure of electronic communication stored or held or maintained or transmitted by an electronic communication service. And the really problematic part is a law enforcement agency may not use, copy, or disclose for any purpose electronic communications provided by an electronic communication service that are not the subject of the warrant. That's the problematic language in our view. Now, firstly, subject of the warrant. I don't know what that means. It's a really vague term. I when I read this, I think the contents of the warrant. The contents of the warrant that's granted by the court. Others have read this interpreted as meaning the person that's identified in the warrant. It's unclear right now, and that's part one why this sub two needs to be stricken. The other part of this is law enforcement agency may not use, copy, or disclose for any purpose. For any purpose. That is all-encompassing. And here's a hypothetical situation that comes up frequently, and that this bill would destroy law enforcement's ability to protect public safety. And that would be, imagine a situation where a peace officer goes and gets a warrant to search somebody's Facebook Messenger because they think that they're running some kind of a drug ring or something like that. And they want to see who they're distributing it to, and they list this all in the probable cause. The judge grants them a warrant. They take it to Facebook and say, can I get these messages? Facebook hands it to them. Because it's a valid warrant. As you're going through this information, you just get a big data dump. You don't get restricted searches to only things that mention drugs specifically. You just get a big data dump. Well, if it's not the subject of the warrant and you see something else that might also be criminal, now you can't do anything because the bill says you may not use, copy, or disclose for any purpose. And so if there's a situation where there's evidence of child abuse and neglect, if there's evidence of child pornography, if there's evidence of these other very serious crimes, law enforcement can do nothing with that. They cannot even use it as the basis for a subsequent warrant so that they can go investigate that crime. Right now, that is the practice. Right now, a warrant is currently required. If you read this statute, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense if you read it in the context of the bill, but if you read the statute 465602, a warrant is already required for all of this information. That's current law right now today. Now, the other problem with that hypothetical I gave, with the evidence being discovered of maybe sexual abuse of children, child pornography, something like that, not only can the police not do anything about it, they now have a conflicting duty. And the reason is 41-3-207. That's the compulsory mandatory reporting statute in the state of Montana. That says if the listed people in that statute become aware of any evidence of child abuse, sexual abuse, or child neglect, they have an obligation to report. The persons that are listed in that are not only teachers, healthcare providers, but peace officers. And so now a peace officer that has gone through this electronic information from Facebook, searching for a drug distribution, and now sees evidence of child abuse or neglect, they have competing duties to, number one, never use this information for any purpose whatsoever, but also have a mandatory reporting. And they can't do both. It's an impossible situation. The other thing I'd like to briefly touch on is some of the testimony of the proponents. As I mentioned, I explained what this data is very, or what this bill is very specifically applying to. That is third-party information. Electronic communications held by a third-party service. We're not talking about mass surveillance. We're not talking about Edward Snowden or the NSA. This bill has nothing to do with that. A warrant is already required for this electronic information that this bill is trying to impact, and that's the current law right now. Mr. Chairman, I think that's all of my comments right now. As mentioned, if the amendment goes on striking that problematic language in Section 2 of the bill, subsection 2, we will withdraw our opposition. So thank you very much. I'll be here for any questions.
Any other opponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Gary Seder. That's spelled S-E-D-E-R. I am the chief for the Crime Information Bureau of the Montana Division of Criminal Investigation at the Department of Justice, where I manage the Human Trafficking Investigations Computer Forensic Unit, and I'm also the Internet Crimes Against Children Commander for the state of Montana. I'm here to testify today in opposition to 479. I have approximately 33 years of law enforcement experience, and during my career I've conducted many search warrants. In my bureau, every case involves some sort of electronic device or search warrant involving information from Facebook or Snapchat or online third-party type platforms. And it's vital that the information that we see in some of that stuff obviously is into the case. Current standards and practices of law enforcement in the state of Montana obviously require us to obtain a search warrant for information. The problem that we oftentimes see is if we do, in fact, we get the results of Facebook Messenger, or maybe it's utilizing a third-party instrument, certified device such as a Gray Key device or a Cellbrite, those types of equipment are designed to go into a physical phone and extract that data. Every phone has a different way on how that data is kept and stored and outlined. That instrument has to go in there, identify that, and remove it. There is no way for us currently to say, only bring out this image or this text messages. Everything gets removed from that phone. That instrument in itself is not capable of doing the search. We then have our forensic examiners that then have to sit down and manually go through all of that evidence. And the problem that we run into if HB 479 is passed as is we oftentimes, I would like to use a couple examples. For instance, if an examiner is to do a search warrant on a phone or they receive this data from Facebook or some other platform, and as they're doing the search and they're looking for specific photos or text messages as outlined in the case on the search warrant, they oftentimes come across something else. In a human trafficking investigation, for instance, oftentimes our victims are very young, from the age of 18 to maybe up to 23. They have had some sort of historic knowledge or dealings with those that are trafficking them in the sex crimes and forcing them into the sex trade. And what we often find are images of those victims prior to what we're searching for at that time. Maybe they're 18 today, but when they met that guy, they may have been 16 or 17. Oftentimes, they could have images in those texts and in those phones or in their messenger of these children or victims under the age of 18, which would constitute child sexual explicit material in our world. As this bill is written, we would not be able to utilize that evidence. We would have to just let it go. We couldn't bring it in. We couldn't take it to prosecution. We wouldn't be able to do the mandatory reporting. So that is one of my concerns. Another scenario I would like to mention is if they're also doing an examination for whatever reason of messages and they come across, let's say we're doing a drug search warrant. A lot of times the drug units will send us a phone or an agent is doing some sort of search on the messenger or some social media type platform. And as we're going through that stuff, we're looking for evidence of drug distribution. Now all of a sudden we come across maybe instead of a picture of a bunch of drugs, the next photo in line that we have to look at to make sure it's not evidence could be evidence of a homicide. Maybe it's a dead body or text messages about a homicide. Again, we would not be able to report that and move that towards prosecution or even let the actual investigating officer know that we saw that information. So those are my biggest concerns in my world with what we do and how we do our investigations. And the other thing, too, is it's important to understand and please know that many times this evidence that we see once we're into these devices or into this Facebook Messenger stuff, we don't know going into it that that could be there. We just know that we have to go in and do what the judge told us to do. Go to this device, go to this platform, look for evidence of drug distribution, look for evidence of human trafficking. Other stuff that's in there, we clearly will not know that until we're physically manually going through this evidence. So by passing of HB 479 that would prohibit us for actually being able to utilize that information and go out and even obtain another search warrant because we can't even notice it, we can't use it, copy it, or anything of that nature. To where typically now if we would come across that, we stop what we are doing, we go back to the judge and say, while doing this, we found this. May we please have a search warrant now to go back into that evidence and continue our search, also looking for that evidence. And that's how it typically works in our cases and our investigations. The other thing I would like to know or remind you as well is we do a lot with third parties. Keep in mind that Facebook has a lot of attorneys. They have a lot of policies. They would never allow us to go in and gather evidence from third parties that are not related. They are very specific. Our search warrants must specify who we are looking for, their specific username, and what we want. We want the messages out of Messenger. We can't separate a lot of that stuff because the way the data comes. We have to get software that literally parses that information, separates that information, and that's where my forensic examiners do their work in the lab. The other thing also is judges expect for us when we go to them with a search warrant, we must have probable cause. We must be specific in what we're looking for. And as I mentioned, many times we don't know if there's other stuff in there. We don't look for it. We don't want there to be other stuff, but we commonly come across that type of additional evidence. And again, we must go back and obtain another search warrant. So again, I thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, I'll be available.
Any other opponents in the room?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Shelby DeMars. That's D-E-M-A-R-S. Here on behalf of the Montana Police Protective Association. And then I'm also Jesse Luther with the Montana Troopers Association, also asked to be added in as an opponent as well. She had a conflicting hearing this morning. But we share the other opponents' concerns with this legislation about the conflicts that this bill, unamended, would create with mandatory reporters and potential limitations on the use of evidence. One section of the original bill that has not had a lot of time spent on it is it would be under the current bill, Section 3, you'll see that that's been stricken and replaced with old Section 4 in the current bill that's been stricken. It's been replaced with a new Section 3. That bill that changes the language on when a law enforcement agency is required to delete information is really critical. Our officers have cases that go on for many years, and often the maintaining and being able to refer back to that data that was obtained through a warrant at a given point in time is very critical to being able to solve those cases later on. So we would just include that as another reason why we feel that the amendments are very critical to this piece of legislation. I would like to just commend the sponsor for the incredible amount of work she's done with the various stakeholders throughout this process. She's been very, very willing to listen and help with amendments that can meet the needs of everybody. That said, with the amendments that have been proposed on this piece of legislation, our opposition would go away. So with that, we would encourage you to pass the amendments on this legislation. Without them, we would oppose the bill.
Any other opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Murphy. I represent the Montana Association of Chiefs of Police. It's good to be back in the birthplace of the modern era of the search warrant. This committee has been instrumental over the years in guiding law enforcement into the proper application of search warrants and privacy. In this, I know I haven't been here as much this session as I have in past sessions. I've been attending budget hearings quite a bit, and I want to present a little bit of a different take on this particular bill. What you have heard today is what happens when you go to Facebook, to Verizon, to some of the international, national level third-party data possessors, and I use that in the broadest sense of the word. But what I've learned watching the budget is that every agency of state government has come to the budget committees and requested additional funds for computer systems, including $100 million for the Department of Public Health and Human Services for Medicare. including corrections for Olmos, including almost all of these have really catchy little names for their computer systems. Nobody's used Skynet at this point, which I hope we don't get to in any time in the future. Even the Public Service Commission has a system they call EDI. What do these systems gather? Third-party data information. In the areas that this committee deals with, you have almost unlimited data on poor people and healthcare. Medicare expansion gathers more data than anybody. So when you look at all of these international committees or companies that gather data, residential companies, residential possessors of third-party data, I can tell you who is the largest possessor of third-party data. But you'd have to get a search warrant to get that information. It's you, folks. You are funding the acquisition of third-party data broadly across the board. Most of it is for administrative purposes, except DPHHS and the Department of Justice also came in for additional funds for Medicaid investigations. So did a number of other agencies that you generally think of as administrative. Even the legislature, at the bottom of your page, it says, please report any fraud, waste, or abuse. You click that, you get to a system to report fraud, and you investigate it using all of the data that you have already gathered. So when we look at these kinds of things, I think we need, and I know that Representative Sullivan has had another bill looking at privacy. I love privacy. Privacy has kept me employed for the last 40 years. So in this kind of a situation, when you start balancing some of the issues of privacy and public safety, it's going to take a comprehensive review. We can't do it piecemeal, and I would ask that you oppose this bill. As it's being amended, I'm not sure what it does, and the timing of it kind of surprises me. This is an update 4 years after the bill was passed, and it came in as comprehensive legislation at that point. There wasn't a single complaint in the operation of this legislation that was local. I didn't prosecute Edward Snowden. I never met the guy. So there's a lot of people that we prosecute locally using this data. We need good guidance from the legislature on how to balance these issues. This bill isn't it. I'd ask you to kill this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any other opponents?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Smith, S-M-I-T-H, and I'm here today representing myself. I'm a retired police officer that has served nearly 24 years in law enforcement. The last 7 to 8 years of my career, I did violent crimes, and I want to speak a little bit today about my most challenging cases, which were homicides. As a detective, I was assigned some of our cold cases, which stretched back to the 80s before we were able to collect this kind of electronic data. But I've also was assigned a case that was from 2005, and I currently have a case from when I was employed that I haven't been able to solve yet. Part of my job is to collect as much information as I could on those cases. And when I think about those cases and I reviewed them and going back to even to the one in the 80s and like 2005, I am looking at all of the information. I'm not just looking at the information the detective at the time thought was relevant. I am looking at all of the information with fresh eyes and trying to help and solve that case, because there is a victim someplace, there's a dead person someplace, and there's a family of that. So This bill would limit my ability to do that, and I'm hoping that my current cold case, or the case I haven't solved yet, will be solved before I'm out of this line of work. But if not, I want to be able to provide that detective that's assigned it in the future the ability to solve that case. So I would oppose this bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Halverson. That's H-A-L-V-E-R-S-O-N. I'm the domestic violence prosecutor for the City of Billings. I prosecute exclusively misdemeanor domestic violence charges within the city limits. And if I may approach Chairman with some documents.
Give it to the Secretary.
So the other opponents have already identified the specific language that would cause problems for law enforcement. I just want to give you a specific example of a case where this would have made our investigation impossible. In 2015, a random unsuspecting woman started receiving cell phone calls from a blocked number. This person would leave messages on her cell phone, would threaten to find her and rape her. We didn't know who this person was. She didn't know who this person was. Through the investigative process and the consent of a judge, we identified the individual who was doing that by getting his phone records. As it so happened, we also identified a number of other phone numbers in succession, hundreds of calls with the block, *67, to women in Montana, out of Montana, some in South Dakota. This offender knew who these women were. They did not know who he was. And it became apparent as he left them the same threatening voice messages about finding them and raping them and identifying one that had decided to move from South Dakota to California, we would not have been able to follow up on that information because at the time we sought the first investigative subpoena, we were looking at one victim and one offender. And surprising to us, there were multiple women across the country. This was not a one-time offender. He was a serial predator. He is a serial predator. The two documents I provided you today started with me at the City of Billings, and it became a felony later prosecuted in the district court. I would ask if this committee does pass this bill that it does so with the amendment so we can continue this very time-consuming and intense work. Thank you.
Any other opponents in the room? Seeing none, there are none online. Informational witnesses in the room? None, none online. Questions from the committee? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Mr. Cedar.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gross, yes.
Chairman, Mr. Cedar, thank you for your testimony. I just wanted to ask if, with the suggested amendment from the sponsor, if your opposition remains or if you would support the bill.
If it would be changed as indicated, we would be okay with that, Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the same question for Mr. Halverson.
Yep.
For the record, Mr. Halverson says his opposition is it goes away if we amend the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Cedar.
That expedited that question, right? Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair.
Into your microphone, please.
Oops, sorry. Mr. Chair, for Ms. DeMars, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber.
Ms. DeMars, you said that you had that there was many cases that are cases that could take many years, and then line 11, page 3, you said that you had an issue with that.
So it would be the in the current bill,
okay,
section 4, but that's been stricken with those amendments and replaced with new section 3, which we are completely okay with.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the proponents and opponents. That was a great bill hearing. I appreciate all this the comments. I just want to say that from this hearing, I hope we can all see that this information that we do share on our social media and on online and with these other companies is information that is used by government agencies in investigations. And so as we all do more Zooming and we're doing more documents online and doing emails, we're just putting more and more of that information into these third parties. And so I think it does show the importance of us trying to strike this balance where we say in our code, let's make sure going forward that there's a warrant before this information is used. And that's what this bill is doing. I would like to make it clear in the code. It sounds like there's a lot of great law enforcement that are already going for warrants, and I appreciate that. But the consensus is not 100% that it's clearly in our code, and we don't know who will be in charge going forward. And so I say, let's add it in. Let's add that line that protects Montanans, but also it sounds like just requires a warrant that is already being used in most cases. I agree 100% with removing Section 2, Sub 2, as suggested by the opponents. From the testimony, it sounds like this language is not clear enough at this time, and it's maybe something I can work on in the future, but I fully support the removal of that language, and I will make sure that amendment is drafted and ready for the committee. I do think this is a step in the right direction. Privacy is important. Let's just make sure we've got it clear, and I would appreciate a due pass from the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This ends the hearing on House Bill 479. Representative Ferris Olson, are you on?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll open the hearing on House Bill 451. Representative, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always nice to be back and to see some familiar faces. Today, I bring you House Bill 451, which is much simpler than I think the rest of the bills you've heard today. All it does is include one section of code that says incarceration includes time spent in a residential treatment facility under the order of a court. So essentially, all this bill does is count. If you go to residential treatment, it counts your time in residential treatment as part of your sentence. So it counts it towards your time served. And why this is important is because of a case that came up in 2015 in front of the Montana Supreme Court. A woman entered a guilty plea, and after she entered the guilty plea, the district court stayed sentencing her until she completed a 12-month-long drug and alcohol addiction treatment, residential treatment, in Billings. So she had a court order to attend that residential treatment facility. She attended it. She spent 12 months there. After she attended it, she was sentenced, and she was sentenced to 8 years with 3 suspended. So 5 years, and I think DOC custody. She asked the court to count her 12 months at the residential treatment facility as part of that time served, so towards that 5 years of the DOC commit. The district court and then the Supreme Court said, no, it doesn't count because it's not considered incarceration under 4618.403. So all this bill does is remedy that kind of situation where an individual is sent by court order to a residential treatment facility. And it's kind of the same as if they were in some other facility. I mean, their freedom's limited. It's not like they're out in the community doing things. They're addressing their addiction problem, trying to get better so that when they're done, they can become better and they can go back into society with their addiction under control. And so this bill just really looks to reward those folks for taking an active step towards solving their addiction problems instead of punishing them by adding additional time to their sentence when someone who's not addressing their problems wouldn't have that additional time. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just hope you can support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. It's obvious there are no proponents in the room. We'll go online. Kelson Young.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Kelson Young with the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I will follow the sponsor's tone and keep it really simple. Bottom line for us is that this promotes access to treatment. We are going to continue to have the societal ills we do if we don't invest in treatment reform and moving on from whatever sort of criminal behavior there was there before. So, Mr. Chairman, we ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Next, Sydney Berry.
Sydney Berry is not online today, Mr. Chair.
Okay. There are no opponents, no informational witnesses. Questions from the committee? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the bill sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Now it seems to me that we hear, you know, or it seems that I hear things that a judge considers the treatment that the people have been through when they're placing the sentence on them. So in a sense, they're already getting some credit for doing some proper things. And then my follow-up to that would be, what do we do with people that are, in this case, they are placed into a program for 6 months, they've been totally uncooperative, and then they are we giving them for time for the 6 months that they've spent where they've not really tried to accomplish what the program was set out to do?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think as you noted, the court has discretion to address some of these issues, but I still think that we're giving, so let's take, I guess, a corollary. Someone goes to DOC and spends that 6 months in jail. They're a terrible inmate. They still get credit for time served. So why shouldn't someone who's under court order attending one of these residential treatment facilities that has their freedoms limited in the same way, but at least is making some sort of effort, even if it's not a great effort. They're in that treatment facility. They're learning about addictions. I just think they need the same rights that someone who's in a jail doing absolutely nothing gets. And like I said, if they don't come out of it and they're just a terror, then the court can take that into account when they give them the full sentence. But I think we need to at least give them the chance and the respect that someone in jail would get.
Thank you.
Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would be for the sponsor as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, would not the judge have the flexibility to suspend another year? In the scenario you're talking about, the judge gave them 1 year, 12 months in a residential treatment facility and then suspended 3 of the 8 years. Could not the judge do the same thing? Don't they have the authority to say, well, maybe we'll, since you successfully completed residential treatment, then I'm going to only suspend you, I'm going to suspend 4 years out of your 8 as opposed to 3 years out of the 8?
Mr. Chair, Senator, potentially, but I think the problem still arises that if the person's not in residential treatment and simply in a detention facility, that counts as time served. And so I think this incentivizes people to attend residential treatment facility programs and to work with the county attorney, the defense attorney, and the court to get placed in those programs. So maybe the court could, but this just makes sure that everyone's treated equally when their liberty is restrained through either a residential treatment facility program or in a detention facility.
Well, Chairman.
Go ahead.
Totally understandable, but I mean, in my jurisdiction, I've seen where judges have reduced people's sentences when they successfully have taken courses and when it comes to treatment in general. So that is the reason why I'm having this question was, you know, if that has that scenario, I'm kind of perplexed on why this is needed.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator, I understand that. And I appreciate that your judges have done that. I think that's admirable. But in the case I'm referencing, it's State v. Byrd from 2015, that didn't happen. And so, again, I just think, well, your judges may be good at that. Not all judges necessarily are. And we just need to make sure we're treating people that are trying to address their problems with the same way we treat people, or we should treat them better, but than those folks that aren't.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I am from Billings, so I'd hope all my judges are doing that good. Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, for the sponsor.
Go ahead.
Representative Ferris Olson, could you just give me a real short explanation of bailable offense? Is that, what is a bailable offense?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I am not entirely sure of the specific definition of bailable offense, but my understanding is that if you are incarcerated pre-trial, you can be given some amount of bail. So you essentially deposit with the court an amount of money or something else that would allow you to leave the detention facility. If you don't return for your hearing, your trial, whatever it may be, then you would lose that money and you'd still be subject to prosecution. So it's not really that relevant to this case, but like if you were, I don't know, arrested for deliberate homicide and you were put on a $100,000 bond, you could bail out by paying $100,000, but you would still be subject to the criminal proceedings. And if you didn't show up, you would then lose that $100,000. That's my understanding, but I haven't done criminal law in many years, and nothing that I did required a bond, generally speaking.
Thank you.
Senator Manzella.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for the sponsor, please. Mr. Chair, Representative Ferris Olson, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this question, but you're the only one here to ask. So can you tell me the costs associated, the daily costs associated with the residential treatment facility versus those of a jail?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't. And I can't tell you, for instance, in the case that I'm referencing, whether the individual was responsible for paying the costs of the residential treatment facility. My guess is she was, but again, I don't know those costs off the top of my head. My understanding as far as the resident, the detention facilities, the state reimburses counties, I think $69 per day, but based on some hearings we heard in the House, that undervalues those costs, or undervalues the true costs.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So you did indicate that in at least some situations, the person being convicted of this situation may be required to pay for the residential treatment facility. Is that what you said? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe so. And again, I'm not 100% sure, but in my limited experience with things like, say, in Helena when I did some criminal defense, if you got a DUI, you were generally responsible for paying for the Prime for Life course here. And so my assumption is that individuals who enter these residential treatment facilities that are private companies generally pay those costs themselves instead of the detention facility where the county or the state pays those costs.
Thank you.
Senator McGilvery.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
You may know this, I don't, but is there a recommendation from the treatment facility that this was a successful completion of treatment? I mean, perhaps someone's in treatment for 6 months or so and it just was a disaster for him. Have you given any thought to the credit for a successful fulfillment of that treatment based on the recommendation of the treatment facility or anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I had not thought too much about that because in the case I keep referencing, it was kind of an agreement between the three parties. So the woman went there, from my understanding, in good faith to attempt to resolve her addiction issues. And so my concern would be that if you do go in there with good faith, and even if it's not a successful treatment, that you should still get, that should still count towards your time served because your liberty is restrained the same way it would be if you were in a detention facility. And we all know that addiction is, generally speaking, an ongoing issue. And so, well, the first treatment may not take the first step in addressing that issue long term. And so I just wouldn't want to exclude someone who's making those good faith efforts to try and address their problem and become a more productive member of society.
Okay, thanks. That's a good answer. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, Representative, you may close on your bill.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a whole lot. Thank you all for the good hearing and the good questions. And again, I think we just need to treat folks who are trying to address their problems the same way or better than we address those that are held in the detention facility and are doing nothing to move forward. So I'd again ask that you support House Bill 451. Thank you all.
This ends a hearing on House Bill 451. Committee, we'll go into executive action. I'll give you a few minutes to get your materials together. We'll start with House Bill 382, and let's have a recess till 11 o'clock. Right at 11 o'clock will be an executive action. Committee, let's be in order. House Bill 382 was by Representative Curdy, dealing with exploding targets on state lands. Is anyone still working on that bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would just ask Julianne, is there an amendment somewhere for that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Est, yes, there's an amendment. One of my colleagues, Joe Coleman, who is the drafter of the bill, prepared the amendment. I sent it out this morning. I think I sent it out last week. I can't remember. But in any event, it's ready. And it's the one that was discussed in the hearing about levels of fire danger. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that 2.1?
Let's see. I believe so. I think that's the only one.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll move do concur with House Bill 382, Mr. Chairman, and then I would move Amendment 382.2.1.
Anyone not have Amendment 2.1? Okay. Senator Esp, did you work on this amendment?
It was the one I asked, Mr. Chairman, it was the one I asked the sponsor about, and he had this prepared, I think.
Okay. Senator Esp, you want to explain it to the committee?
It just clarifies that, Mr. Chairman, that the dangerous fire conditions are further defined instead as that the fire danger is high, very high, or extreme.
Okay. Questions, comments on the amendment? Okay, let's try a voice vote on Amendment 2.1 for House Bill 382. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Nay. Okay, so passed unanimously.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 382 be concurred as amended.
Okay. Questions, comments on the amended bill? Senator Sands.
To quote our former Senator D. Brown, you can't legislate stupid. You think people would have some common sense in high fire danger not to go do exploding targets. That's why we have legislation.
Aren't you intrigued to try it, though? No. Okay. Anyone else on the amended bill? Okay, let's do a roll call vote on amended bill, House Bill 382.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
Yes.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Heinbach?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
Senator Bennett?
Senator Bennett is yes by proxy. I know his internet's a little shaky.
Okay.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
Senator Brown? No. Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
Yes.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
10 members have voted aye. 1 member has voted no.
And Senator Gross was Senator Bennett aye by proxy on the amendment as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. House Bill 382 is passed. We have volunteer for on the floor. Okay, Senator Sands. We'll carry that on the floor. Next, we'll look at House Bill 439 was by Representative Galloway and another landlord-tenant law bill. Anyone still working on amendments? Okay.
I would move do concur in House Bill 439. And, Mr. Chairman, in your packet, you should have Amendment 439.1.1. I would move that amendment.
Okay. Anyone not have Amendment 1.1 for House Bill 439? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, it was just handed out moments ago.
Okay.
And
Mr. Chairman, can you explain it?
We'll get to it.
No.
Senator Sands, did you find it?
Well, read mine. Oh, you got it. There you go.
You put it in the folder, didn't you? Yeah, right where it should be. Okay, Ms. Burkhart, could you fill us in on this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just emailed this amendment out this morning, right about the time the hearing started at 8 o'clock this morning, just so you know. It just came in during the evening after, overnight, and it was waiting for me when I got online this morning. If you turn to, let's see, subsection 4, which begins on page 1, starting at line 26, and then you go, excuse me, to the end of line 28, there is some stricken language, and the language that is stricken is the same day or 24 hours after being issued by the court, and that's speaking of the writ of assistance. That language has been changed to subsection A, which would be the writ of assistance must be executed by the sheriff within 5 business days of the sheriff receiving the writ of assistance, excluding the date of receipt by the sheriff, or at a time no more than 5 business days after the sheriff receives the writ of assistance or has otherwise agreed to by the landlord and the sheriff. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, comments on the amendment? Senator Brown.
I think just a question more. Does the, and anybody I guess can answer this, does the landlord have the option of holding that writ until they feel, you know, they may, I see this as a way to kind of clean up some of the court mess, you know, we'll get it done, they'll have that in their possession and need to have it to use at the, if need be, I guess is the way I'm kind of looking at it. Do they have the ability to hold that and not have the sheriff just do it automatically at 5 days?
Senator, at the last part of the amendment says, or as otherwise agreed to by the landlord and the sheriff.
Okay, I missed it in the copy I didn't have, so.
Okay. Senator Sands?
Mr. Chairman, maybe it's a question for Ms. Burkhart. So I'm a little confused here because on line 28 on the front it says, the writ of assistance must be executed by the sheriff within 5 days. Oh, there's an or, so that or is the significant thing. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions, comments on the amendment?
Question.
Okay, we'll do a roll call vote on Amendment 1.1 for House Bill 439.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
What?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator S?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Fidel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
9 members have voted aye, 2 members have voted no.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move to concur in House Bill 439 as amended.
Questions, comments on the bill as amended? Okay, we'll do a roll call vote on House Bill 439 as amended once.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator S?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Fidel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
7 members have voted aye. 4 members have voted no.
President Blaisdell will carry that one on the floor. Next committee, we'll look at House Joint Resolution 4. It was by Representative Cafaro, dealt with an interim study of the criminal commitment process and placement of individuals dealing with mental illness. Anyone working on amendments to that?
Mr. Chairman, Julianne, do we have that amendment out of editing yet?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Esp, I have not received that amendment back from editing yet.
Mr. Chairman, Julianne, do you think I could move it as a conceptual amendment?
We don't need to mess. We'll just put it aside. Let's put HJ4 aside and go to House Bill 229.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to concur in House Bill 229.
Okay, this was by Representative Gillette, an act prohibiting qualified health insurance plans offered through a health insurance exchange in Montana from covering abortion services. And Ms. Burkhart, any amendments?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, questions, comments on the bill? Senator Sands?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is just another in the long line here of making it more difficult for women who have made this decision and have the legal and constitutional right to make a decision, that it makes it even more difficult for them to be able to then exercise that right by prohibiting that access to insurance that men can get for vasectomies. You can get it to have your uterus removed, but you can't have it for an abortion. I think this is complete government overreach into telling a business, the insurance industry, what it can do and not do, as well as prohibiting women from making their constitutional right to make their own health decisions, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments? Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, it was said in the hearing that, you know, and I have to agree with this, it takes away the right of women. The right of women's health takes away. It is also already illegal in federal law, and it directly interferes with women and their doctor.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll do a roll call vote on House Bill 229.
Vice Chair McGilvery?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sands?
No.
Senator Esp?
Yes.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Bennett?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Fidel?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No.
Chairman Regeer?
Yes.
7 members have voted aye. 4 members have voted no.
We have a volunteer for on the floor. Okay, I'll carry that one. Good job, committee. You're hanging in there, doing a good job. We will not meet Monday morning. Not meet Monday morning. Okay? Anyone have anything for the good of the committee? Okay, we are adjourned.